the meeting of the Sard Sand Outdoor Heritage Council to order. Thank you all for your promptness this morning. The first thing is to review and approve the agenda. The one thing I see that's not on the agenda is a discussion of a potential meeting in July. So I'd like to add that to the end of the agenda. That's all right. Is there a motion to approve the agenda with that correction?
So moved.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Just a question. We don't have a lot of business today other than an accomplishment plan approval conveyance of an easement, but any conflicts of interest that anyone wants to report? Okay, great. So we have minutes from March 18th. Someone wants to make a motion to approve the minutes? Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Do we have Scott on the phone?
Oh.
We don't have him, so I don't need a roll call vote. Yes. Bob, your first meeting with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll go around the room and just have everyone introduce themselves to give you a little flavor. I'm David Hartwell from Minneapolis.
Jim Cox from Colm.
State Senator Ingebrigtsen from Alexandria.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Scott.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hi, Scott.
Scott. Jane Kingston from Edinburgh.
Elizabeth Wilkins from Moore.
Rick Hansen, South St. Paul.
Candy Smith Staff.
Heather Coop Staff.
Roger Ramsey.
Bob Anderson, International Falls.
Sue Olson, Austin.
Bill Becker, staff.
And Scott Rawl is there.
Correct.
We have your name tag by the phone, Scott.
Wonderful.
You look good.
As good as I can get. The name tag probably does better.
So, we'll move into an executive director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your packet, you have the adopted council schedule. As usual, we pass one out at each meeting. It's the same that we adopted in March of last year, or this year. We'll get into the session report in a minute. I think that it's important for the council to know that we're in discussions with LCC to add a half a position and to redefine positions in the council staff position so that there's a better career track movement from one to another. I'll keep you up to date as we go forward on that. Anyone who has any problems or objections, please let us know. But for the half a position, probably have to go into our carry forward to take care of that in a short run. It would be included in the next administrative budget. With that, and with the knowledge that we're going to go into a legislative update and a discussion of legislative sessions, is there any question about staff and what we're doing these days?
Sure.
Bill. So the new half person, what will they be doing? Just basically,
the idea is to have them take over some of the clerical duties that Sandy's doing. Write Sandy's position upwardly to a project manager type of position, assistant, and have her report more directly to Heather, and that would affect Heather's position. So I value everybody's human resources experience. Would be happy to hear from anybody on this plan. It will require some agreement from LCC, is my understanding. So, legislative update?
Rick?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I have a question about the LCC and just timing. Because I know in the House we have a Rules Committee meeting next week, and I think the legislative auditor is going to be here, but the LCC umbrella with timing of any cost of living adjustments or the budget. I'm just wondering about sequencing timing that staff would have here, because I know, for example, the legislative auditor, they do not know their budget yet. The executive branch has their cost of living contractual changes, but being employees in the legislative branch, I'm assuming that you do not have any idea what will be happening there yet.
I, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I've heard rumors, but nothing repeatable. And the objective is to put whatever it is in place by the 1st of July. That's pretty quick. My objective in terms of what we're doing is to have it, any changes come after the COLAs, after the changes in the event there's an increase in salary range, that sort of thing.
Maybe to clarify, Mike, I'm assuming that the authority probably rests with the LCC on any COLAs rather than within this body.
Yes. That's very clear to me.
We have no authority.
And like other legislative employees, we haven't seen any change in salary in the 5 years I've been here.
Okay.
So shall we talk a little bit about the legislative session? You have session highlights in your packet. I'm not going to go through this in detail. It's 100 pages of changes in law, but I just wanted to point out some major areas where work took place. And on page one, you'll find the drainage system statute modification, which basically is a replacement of ditch records and then a redefinition of repair, including reducing channel erosion and multi-ditch reconstruction. I think it's important for us to keep up on the ditch law in the state. And so then on page five, we have the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund legislation. Some of the highlights there are a wetland inventory update, a woodland grazing study on page seven, native prairie fee and easement. You'll find the Arboretum acquisition, which pairs up with our appropriation on page nine, and at a 4F on the same page, conservation land reenrollment assistance. This is an effort to keep people in the federal programs that set aside land. Page 10, they have 4G, which is moose research, 4J, which is, or I'm not sure which one, I think it's 4I, conservation grazing on WMAs, on page 11, 4L, restoration evaluations. I wanted to point this out in terms of the amount of effort they're putting into restoration evaluations versus the amount we put in and the way it's structured. It's within the legislative commission. Ours is outside of the legislative commission. On page 12, the LCCMR funds a Heron Lake effort to deal with water quality in Heron Lake and a southwest or southern Minnesota lake restoration project. 5E, an interesting project to measure the hydrological hydrologic benefits from glacial ridge habitat restoration. Glacial Ridge, those of you who are familiar with it, is a major prairie restoration in northwestern Minnesota on a large scale. It's an extraordinarily large scale. And if it doesn't show water quality and flood retention benefits, I don't know what will. Pages 14 and 16 is a series of invasive species. In fact, the entirety of Subdivision 6 is four invasive species. The Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources invested almost $11 million in invasive species in this section over the 2 years that it appropriated. On page 17 of the document, I have highlighted under Subdivision 9 availability the language that the LCCMR is using for reimbursable costs or uses of the fund. It's a little different from our approach to this, and you may want to look that over. The next part of the document, I believe, is a series of changes in statute. The one I wanted to point you to was on page 27, which is a revision of the way lands are approved for acquisition. It strengthens the commissioner's authority. We had this language in our bill and frankly disappeared. And it continues over on page 28. Basically, what the idea here is to make sure that acquisitions are properly valued and are in the public interest. It's public money. We've got to make sure that it's public interest is being served by the acquisition. On page 29 is Chapter 114, which is the Environment, Natural Resources, and Ag Finance Bill. Take note in Article 2 on pollinator report. On page 30, there's a highlighted section that deals with invasive species. On page 31 is in lieu of tax from the lottery income. And I just wanted to point out that there's money going to purposes that are similar to, if not exactly the same, as the OHF. This may be an issue someday in supplementing, supplanting, that sort of thing. Going on to page 34, aquatic invasive species money, and page 35, aquatic invasive species money. And I don't know if anybody has done a summary in these bills. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen.
Yeah, House Research has done a summary of AIS, so I can get that. I just got that.
That would be nice to have. And I wanted to draw your attention to DNR Operations Support, which is Subdivision 8 on page 36. And if you read that appropriation, none of the appropriated support services money goes to DNR support services. All of that comes out of programs in DNR as a transfer, I think is the best way to describe it.
What did you just say?
Well, we fund in our budgets a line called support services, which is for writing checks for employees, assisting in purchasing, doing other background work that's necessary for a project to take place. In DNR, there's no general fund money for that kind of work. It's all transferred out of programs in the department into an area called support services on a contractual basis with the programs in DNR. So, as an example, there would be a wildlife management area management program in Fish and Wildlife. They would pay the support services unit that includes the financial division, it includes the human resources division, it includes fleet. They would pay on a contractual basis a sum certain for the services during the period covered, which I believe is a biennium. I've forgotten. Having been there 5 years ago. It's a pay-as-you-go, user-pays system. We participate in it. I'm showing you this just to demonstrate that there's no general fund money applied to this particular service. Did that clear that up? We'll have what else to do. If I'm confused, you, we've got to straighten it out.
Please. So general fund funds the programs, and then the programs fund the support services.
Mr. Chair, Councilor Kingston, general fund and other fund.
Right.
In fact, there is a concept called fund responsibility or something like that, where they're to make sure that each fund pays its fair share, and we participate in our fair share. It's a business within the department, basically what it is. Page 39 is the Met Council appropriation out of the general fund, I believe. Article 4 on page 39 is a DNR habitat, pollinator habitat program, and just note that all of the restorations must take into account pollinator habitat. On page 40, I wanted to point out part of the silica sand mining model standards and criteria, specifically subdivision 2 at the bottom of the page, and the standard and criteria that it sets includes setbacks, effects on trout stream, critical habitat inputs. This has to do with the environmental review of silica sand mining, and attempts to ensure that it's well reviewed. I put the fish and game bill in starting on page 42 because of the constitutional requirement that all land purchased in fee with the Outdoor Heritage Fund be open for hunting and fishing. All of these laws now apply to our property. So you may want to squeeze through that. On page 63 is the omnibus legacy bill. Actually, during the session, it's got to be the ominous legacy bill.
Yes.
And you are familiar with most of it. I wanted to take you to page 77, section 3, the biennial recommendation study. Just bring you up to date, we're working with the management analysis division out of administration to discuss designing and implementing a study of biennial versus annual recommendations. And we will be back to you with more information on that.
Yeah.
David, Bill, what did we end up with our bottom line?
I don't like to get that close.
Nine plus 3, 12. Janelle, does that sound right?
I believe it's 12. I'm looking for somebody knowledgeable. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, I'm wondering if it's closer to 11. I'm thinking it might have only been about 2%. Representative Kahn is actually here. She might remember what the proposal was, but I think it was about $2 million on the bottom line. Do you remember, Mike? Yeah, I don't think it was $3 million.
You better say it again. So, we just got here.
I think Representative McNamara is correct. It was $2 million in the proposed settlement, and $9 million was added to that for $11 million. I think that's what we'll find if we look at the spreadsheet.
Is that close enough?
Yes. On page 87 of the same bill, I wanted to point out the Board of Water and Soil Resources section, specifically the watershed-based approach that's being taken throughout the bill. You'll find strong watershed emphasis, which is a transition in the way some of these programs work. Page 89, you'll find the conservation easement that's linked to our buffers program, where we extend the buffer out for fish and game purposes. Again, on page 90, watershed basis to approach the water quality. In the Metropolitan Council appropriation, the legacy funding is on page 96. And a total of $3 million, it looks like. And on page 100, there's a provision in paragraph O, which is a law instructing the Met Council to provide recommendations to legislature for the next biennium. This is recommendations for use of the parks and trails money. And on page 102, again, omnibus tax bill. I wanted to say just a little bit about that. And the property tax bill removes the SFAI cap for land if the for land that has an easement on it, if the easement is less than 60,000 acres in size, and it guarantees public access on east land. This is relevant to the Malthus situation and to the Forest Legacy situation. One of the primary objectives of Malthus was to get their tax situation under control, and this helps by having the SFAI payments. They used to be capped at $100,000, they're not capped at $7 an acre. So with that, that's what I followed and found what happened in the session. Perhaps the legislators would have other information that they would like to brought forward.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, go back to the Metropolitan Council request. We're requesting them to do what now? I skipped over that real quickly. What page was that? The request for proposals.
In the omnibus, it's on page 100, and it's for the next biennium's use of parks and trails money, as I understand it. And the legislature is authorizing and instructing them to provide a list of projects to be funded by that fund. They're using the Met Council to vet projects. Met Council solicits from their implementing agencies projects that are in the capital improvement plan for the Metropolitan Parks and Recreation Open Space System. They evaluate those, rank them, and turn them in over to the legislature for inclusion in a bill. Much like what we do, only it's on a project-by-project basis as opposed to a more programmatic basis.
We've never done that. Sure, they've never done that in the past.
I don't think they've been formally asked to. I think
that's true, right?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Becker, the House environment or the House legacy staff is behind us, and they acknowledge that they've done that, but it's in the past, but it was never formally requested. And now it's clarified that they will do that and continue to do that so that they have a priority. Just what Mr. Becker said.
So, Mr. Chair, that's the core of the legislative update. I understand that we have other things to talk about in this time period. I think you may want to lead the discussion.
Sure.
Question.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to go to the tax bill 102 and 103. And Bill mentioned it. On page 102, the subdivision, section 2, subdivision 6, relates to Malthus. And so I'm wondering, when I'm looking at the line that says any land that becomes subject to the conservation easement, so that it's anticipating that this will get an easement. And you know, during the session, there were rumors that the fix was in for MOPIS to get the conservation easement in the next round here. And now we have Axel that says if it becomes subject. So that's one question on that provision. But then I look on page 103 on section 34, and that relates back to section 2, subdivision 6. And the land exceeding 60,000 acres, I'm assuming that's abandoned property, there's land adjustment. So section 34 says that the land in easement would be released from the covenant, the SFIA covenant for sustainable forest practices. Is that what section 34 does?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I haven't studied it that close. So perhaps Janelle, are you in some detail?
Mr. Chair, members, I haven't really looked at this language in detail. I did briefly talk with our tax staff, but I can go back since they were more involved in that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think if it pleases the council, we'll get something in writing on what this exactly means. I think it's a little dangerous to interpret it on the fly.
Mr. Chair, it's a big question, though. If we have properties that are either in the easement that had a covenant to meet the SFI tax rate, and then they're released from the covenant to do the practice, either after an easement is paid for by the public, or if it applies to anticipated public purchase. I think we need to know that, if, because we're dealing with tax policy here related to easement policy. It's murky ground. It appears to be new. And particularly as we go through the project proposals, if there are things coming that by enrolling in, they've received tax amendments that are brand new. The council needs to be fully aware of that.
Mr. Chair, by the next meeting, we'll have an exposition on what this does together. In writing.
Anyone want to guess what it means? Wait.
Chair, I wouldn't begin to guess, but an easy way to find that out would be to do just exactly what's being talked about here, get over the tax chair, tax staff over on the Senate side, and then just go over to the House and give an interpretation there back to the committee.
Thank you. Yeah.
Any other general questions? So, I just want to start this by maybe a personal reflection on what happens. As you know, the House had a bill that reflected many of our recommendations and went beyond many of our recommendations and brought in some new ones. The Senate basically adopted what we had recommended, and it ended up in a conference committee, and a deal was struck which included some of the House provisions, which ultimately the governor vetoed those added provisions. I know there are some people who think somebody won. I'm here to tell you from my perspective, nobody won. We clearly have some things we have to consider going forward in terms of how we respond to what happened. What we saw was in the House there was a desire or a concern that we did not consider habitat in the metro area as important as other areas. I would argue that we have looked at habitat and have been interested in habitat in the metro area. But there's no question there's a feeling that we did not give a specific proposal enough attention. And frankly, as I look back individually, I think there was a proposal for the Metro Parks that came in that had some elements that were good and some elements that were unacceptable, and I ranked that very low because it was lumped together. And I think in hindsight, that probably was defendable, but not the wisest political decision. And we're going to see proposals come back from the metro area for habitat, both inside and outside of parks. And if anything, what this section has to have said to us is that we need to be very careful as we're doing things and not treat a proposal such as we looked at for parks as one proposal, but as multiple proposals. Bill and I had an opportunity to meet with the most of the parks people last week and talk to them. Frankly, encourage them to apply because this money is for habitat no matter where it is. It's not about urban or rural. It's about habitat in general. Suggested there were a few criteria they needed to think about. One, that the proposals were actually habitat. A second, that they give some consideration to cost, because some of the proposals we saw were far elevated in cost on a per acre basis. And there are going to be discrepancies depending on the work you're doing and where you're doing it, but it would be hard for us to not be interested in how big a piece you're doing and how much it costs in our analysis, whether it's metro or anywhere else. And we also encourage the group to put in multiple proposals because lumping all of the habitat proposals in the metro area that are part of the park system as one proposal is really hard to then evaluate the good or the bad of any one proposal. I think they appreciated us being there. I think their intention is to probably move forward with a joint proposal instead of with individual proposals. I'd like to actually have a discussion about that and see what the council would recommend to them in terms of a strategy for how we would like to see proposals and what makes the most sense to give them the fairest opportunity. But the one thing I'm quite certain of is that we cannot ignore what happened and pretend that we can go about business without thinking about this somewhat differently, because it's a real issue. There's frankly no perfect answer as to you spend money where people are or where the habitat is, which is the big sort of question. Most of people live in the metro area. Most of the land is not in the metro area. I think we've done a pretty reasonable job in the past of supporting projects in the metro area as they come to us. Not everyone agrees with that. We need to have a very open debate about that among ourselves and making sure that we're making decisions that we have thought through very well so that they are defendable as we go forward, because it's going to be questioned more strongly than it has been even in the past. And we owe it to the people that we're trying who are paying the bill and we're trying to do a good job for, to make sure we have a vigorous debate about this and make sure we get it as right as we possibly can. I have no doubt, no matter what we do, there are people who are going to say that we're not doing the right thing. So what I ask you to do is make sure that we think about it very carefully so that we're clear we've done as good a job as we possibly can. I think we also are going to have a discussion about AIS, which has a lot of
it's my alarm clock.
AIS has some traction in the legislature. It's frankly a very difficult issue to know how to involve ourselves in AIS efforts that really have permanent solutions, which is kind of fundamentally what we have said we want to do and have projects that provide a legacy. Because boat inspections on a part-time basis do not keep AIS from getting into waters, which, frankly, I don't know how we resolve that. I think the legislature needs to resolve the issue by much more strongly controlling the movement of boats and structures from one water body to the next. Because until you do that, you're going to have AIS problems. I was lucky enough to be fishing in Argentina in January. You cannot move a boat from one water body to the next without decontamination. Or you will lose your license, you will pay big fines. If you're a guide, you will not guide anymore. And it's very serious in Argentina. And we don't require the same in Minnesota. So that's not our issue. We can't force that in any way. But until then, we're going to have pressure to do something about AIS. And we've tried to do it with TARP because it's more controllable. Zebra mussels and milfoil and some of the rest are much more difficult because there is no good control other than 100% prevention. Once you've got zebra mussels in a lake, you're not going to take them out, at least with current technology. But we need to have a discussion about that. And frankly, we're going to talk a little bit about our July meeting. I think my recommendation is that we have a meeting and we have a tour in the metro area looking at some habitat projects in the metro area and have a more in-depth discussion about AIS and what would be the place where we could actually have some influence and do the right thing by the fund and by the people who are paying the bills. So that's my take on the session. It was a brutal experience for everyone involved. Nobody won. Those that think we somehow won don't understand that there were no winners in this. There are a lot of people who feel that things were not done right and fair on all sides, which is a true indication of things not being in a position where there are winners. So I'm happy to hear from other people in terms of the session and thoughts that they may have had hearing about the session. I will say, as your chair, it's very hard as you go through the session because of the open meeting law not to be able to have discussions with each one of you individually as people are calling and asking, what does the council think? There is no way to do that, which means that if I in any way said something at some point and you read it in the paper or somebody told you what I said to someone and you don't agree, you have every right to criticize, and I'm sorry, I've done the best that I can given the circumstance of really not being able to poll everybody and try to develop a better consensus view, but it is the rules we work under. Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to once again applaud the governor for making the decision that he did with regards to the line item vetoing it. And I understand your concern moving forward. I think that this body, especially with new members, should know what exactly we as the state of Minnesota, has spent on AIS statewide, what initiatives we've had. The governor himself has had a just recently a CARP summit, I believe it was called. So I know his administration is certainly concerned about it and cares about it and has, quite frankly, spent an awful lot of our resources on it. And we should, and I think Representative Hansen may have this figure, I know he's been doing some research, at least some, that way that we're going to have an idea as to what we have spent over the last 5 to 6 years. Not necessarily legacy money, but statewide money, and what the outcomes are. And with regards to parks, it still is not very clear to me. I think there's a mechanism in place, and I guess I could ask Mr. Becker if the DNR has ever received a call or received any documentation from the DNR with regards to funding of park programs. Oh, we went through this, for instance, we went through this proposal from the Met Council, and this seems like a good one for Lasard Sands. Has that ever happened at all? Because I'm assuming they have to do the same thing there that the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails has to do in order to get the funding.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hagan, right to my knowledge, has DNR ever redirected a request to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, which I think is what you're asking.
Yes, I am, and I'm assuming that they would know the Constitution as well as we do, and how we've I think used that document to guide our decisions here over the past and quite successfully. I'm just happening to be thinking here if there were any of those projects that they ended up funding for the Met Park that should have come here.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to sort of bring Gretchen to understand that the Met Council is responsible for the portion of the legacy fund that goes to Met Council Parks. And that doesn't go through DNR. DNR is responsible for the non-Met Council regional projects and is responsible for the state park project.
Any other thoughts on the session or comments? Rick?
Mr. Chair, I agree with your assessment that nobody won. But I think one of the challenges that the legislature sees, and we could agree with that, but we haven't had much of a discussion about whether anybody won or not. But on all sides of the issue, we have special interest groups that receive money from the council, or want to receive money from the council. And the folks that lobby go back to their employers, and they have to say whether they want or not. They have to justify their time and effort. And I think one of the concerns that came up during this is the influence and the effectiveness of special interests on the whole side of this, that interest for AIS have lobbyists, interest for parks have lobbyists, interest for the Nature Conservancy have lobbyists, interest for MOHA have lobbyists, and there's lobbyists all around, and they can lobby the council and lobby the legislature, and they live in a win or lose situation. They go back to their boards and say, we want those laws, and that's not going to change, I think, but that's part of this whole thing. And I don't think that's going to change. You have people who want to win, and it doesn't matter what the content is. You ask them what the content is, and they can't describe it. They just describe winning or losing. And I think as members of a body, that advisory body that provides recommendations, as legislators, we get a little numb to that. We have people on all sides of the issue come all the time and want something. Everybody wants something. And I think we need to realize that here, that everybody wants, there's nobody pure. in terms of the goodness of their effort. They all want something. They have $100 million a year. They want the money. And some have gotten the money before, and some want to get the money. It's always about the money. So I think we have to take everything with a grain of salt when we're dealing with the lobbyists, because they are in a different moment. They're advocating for their client. That's a different role than what we have. We're supposed to advocate for the people who are. And that may mean telling lobbyists, I'm not going to agree with you. Or, that's interesting, I'd like to hear the other side. I think we have to think about that as we go forward.
Yeah, I think what we need to do is the best job we possibly can. We know what our charge is. We need to take that seriously, and I think this body has. When you go through what we went through, to not ask ourselves, could we have done a better job, would be the wrong thing to do. Can we learn something? I think the thing that I found most painful about all of this is, and I'm sure, Rick, you see it all the time, but what was being said wasn't always the facts to support a position. And you and I might not agree on something, but we ought to be able to agree on the facts. And then have a different perspective. And there was an awful lot of facts that simply weren't true in the discussion. I don't know if we'll ever get past that. But to me, that was the discouraging thing. Not necessarily the disagreement, but that we weren't dealing with reality in all circumstances, which is another reason for us to just make sure that what we do is as clear as possible, as well thought out as possible, as defensible as possible. And I think we have done that in the past. I think we need to ask ourselves, is there anything we can do to make that even better? And that's all I would say. Denny?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for meeting with the Parks people. I've met with the ones in my area because I was one of the vocal people that was in the House that was opposed to the addition of the Metro Parks, not because a lot of those projects were really strong proposals. I just felt we should honor the process a little better. But just some observations that I came up with. I think the majority of those proposals were very strong. Specifically, there was a couple in Representative Hansen's in my county and Dakota County that were really awesome projects. I think there was a couple, as you've already stated, that were weaker proposals and maybe didn't meet the criteria we're used to. I think we'll see them come back. I've encouraged them to consider going separately and maybe together a couple different ways to look at and to make sure they realize what we have, what we fund and what the Constitution says we're about. Just for instance, the area in Dakota County that many of us worked on when we built the University of Minnesota football stadium, the UMAR Vermilion Highland WMA, is now a collection of probably approaching 5,000-6,000 acres of either owned or conservation easement land in the Empire Township, which is an unbelievably strong area for proposals in the metro that is true habitat. Currently at least 2 miles wide wildlife area, just a tremendous one. I think we'll see more proposals hopefully for that area going forward. In regards to the AIS, I just wrote down some notes here. I'm going to try and buzz through them. I think this group needs to focus on the fact, you made a statement that, and I don't know, Mr. Chair, I don't want to agree with it, because you said the boat ramp inspections don't necessarily stop it. Well, I will tell you, on the lake that we have a cabin, in the last 4 years, two different instances of either zebra mussel or Eurasian milfoil were stopped by a DNR boat inspector. So they were. Is that appropriate that that be funded from here? A lot of folks will tell you the best thing we can do against AIS is concentrate on native fish habitat. And that clearly is within our realm to play that role. I think LCCMR funding Dr. Sorensen. Dr. Sorensen is our answer in the reality long term. His and his people and his programs, you know, I think can maybe help us long term for it. The fee, Representative Hansen's got a terrific bill, the AIS fee bill, which I argued all along was the fee we should have concentrated on this year. Hopefully we can get it next year. That'll fund it. It's a bullet fee that not only for resident but non-resident votes. It's a really good bill. I mentioned when we were dealing with the governor and the hope that some of us hoped he would veto this. And, you know, I know Representative Kahn's right behind me. I really respect where she was coming from because a lot of those projects in the metro did get shortchanged, and I certainly hope that they get funded next year with our recommendations. But I just think it wasn't right to totally upend our process, which we did. And a couple of the other ones, in regards to the open meeting law, I've been a critic of this group. We should be meeting during session, folks. You can't have your head in the sand and say, well, we made a recommendation in November and we're living by it come H or high water. Sorry, things change. And this group should be willing to come back. If you go back, I will strongly recommend Ms. Taylor drafted the amendment. We had an Erdahl amendment that we offered in Legacy where I serve. Representative Hansen and I serve on the committee ad hoc. We don't get to vote, but we can be part of the discussion. And some of you on this group would be mad that we offered that amendment, but it offered the Metro Parks, I believe, $5.3 million of a competitive grant money because we recognized there was a couple of those parks that didn't probably wouldn't work, but it would have been a competitive grant. It had to qualify as far as fish and wildlife habitat. That would have given the Metro Parks $5.3 million. As you remember, we had $4 million extra in a secondary RIM application. So we offered that, and then at that time we still thought MOFIS needed some money, so we had some of that in there, and then we had the potential to go to a two-year recommendation, letting that be decided in conference committee. I think that if we met later in session, this group could weigh in on some of that stuff and be part of the process instead of hanging our head on Bud Grant writing a letter to the governor and say, remember the video. I mean, we all had that video on our phones that the governor has. That puts him in a tough spot where I'm really grateful that he did what he did. We need to recognize we got to really work hard on our recommendations. This group's been really good about the open process and transparency. But boy, make sure, be careful if you start making deals where, you know, I'm going to do your project and you do mine. We're going to vote for it that way. That's what got the old LCMR in trouble, and this group has really skirted that so far, so I think we need to recognize that. But I will tell you, if we continue to say we're not going to meet in session, we need our recommendations, and, you know, we're going to stick by them, I think that's a mistake. I think we need to be ready to adapt. So I think it is a learning experience, and those projects, when you look at them, there's some good projects in the metro we should be funding, but this is about hunting and fishing habitat, and where is that? Most of it is in outstate Minnesota, and if you live in Hastings, Minnesota, like I do, we hunt and fish in outstate Minnesota, but doggone it, there's a lot of people in St. Paul that want to be able to go to Vermilion Highlands, 18 minutes away from right where we are right here. When we first got on that bus in 05 or whatever it was, we rode the bus down to the Umore land. It was 18 minutes and we were at that area. And it's 2 miles wide of great public hunting and access. And it's a trophy designated trout stream, the only one in the nation, right in our metro. So that thing is just waiting for over the next 20 years. We can make that area an unbelievable area. And it's in the metro. And I think it's our best opportunity. There's some up in the Anoka County that we funded, like Columbus and stuff, that are really good. So I think we're going to see strong proposals. But if I'm not mistaken, I know I've recommended before when we did recommendations, I wouldn't fully fund a project. And I would say in our notes that I think we should delete one part of it because I didn't think it was good as the other. I think the other members should know that we can do that. If it, like, you know, we could have said on this one, that it was 6.3 and I think we should fund five of it and I don't think we should do these two or whatever. you know, just a for instance, it might have led. And you need to remember what Representative Lilly sat right next to me, and he said, folks, we're going to be in trouble if you don't recognize the metro is getting shortchanged. He warned us. He told us absolutely that you guys need to recognize what was coming. And Representative Lilly, he's a fortune teller. He told us exactly. And I think, I'm hoping that will. And Representative Hansen's here now to advocate just like he did. So hopefully we're going to figure it out.
Thanks, David. I'd like to ask David and Bill, since you met with the parks people. It seemed like the parks was a big part of the heartburn of this whole last bill. And I really had a hard time understanding that, because parks gets a portion of the legacy money already. They get bonding money. They get a big general fund donation. We've funded parks in the past. Anoka County, we've given them $4 or $5 million. And then we turn around and John Vanderlyn is ripping us in the paper. Good parks projects that have come before this council have been funded, and they've been funded generously. So I'm having a hard time understanding where the angst coming from the parks advocates for how we've done business. They've got their own part of the legacy funding. They get generously funded through bonding and general appropriation. We've funded parks projects in the past very well, and yet it sounds like, you know, we've ignored them. They came in with a project that David's already explained last year, which is very poorly put together, a number of projects crammed together that were going to be overseen by the Met Council. Was going to be a, they were going to actually re-grant the money, and because we didn't, we had the audacity to say, well, you know, this really doesn't pass the smell test, that somehow we're anti-park. It's just not true. They get a lot of money from the state. We have, in the past, funded parks very well when they came through with projects that were, that met our criteria. So again, I don't understand where all the angst came and where all the negative feelings came towards this council, that we've got some kind of a bias against parks or metro parks, because it's just not true.
Well, I think the issue of the fact that we have funded habitat projects in parks in metro areas was one of the frustrating things that no one wanted to listen to in the session that I was referring to, in terms of the true facts not being there. That being said, you know, we have funded projects that affect clean water, even though they have a fund. I don't think it's wrong for the parks people to want to apply for restoration of habitat, to habitat, wherever it is. I agree with you. The proposal that was submitted wasn't very strong because it had some stuff in it that, frankly didn't meet our criteria or was cost prohibitive. But there were buried in that some projects we probably should have listened to. That's hindsight. I am hoping this group might make a recommendation to the parks community to not lump very different projects all into a single proposal, but instead apply on the merit of individual projects, so that we can take a closer look, as we have done with Anoka Parks, with the funding we've done in Dakota County for their easement program, for, which is a habitat, not a parks project. So we're truly looking at habitat wherever it is. But I think it's very confusing to look at a project that covers the entire metropolitan area and habitat in that isn't even similar habitats as one single project. where if we could look at them as projects that stand on their own merits, one, as we do for everything else, we would look at and treat those projects that really are habitat-based differently than we did as they were lumped together. So, Jim, I don't disagree with you entirely. I don't think that it's wrong for us to look at what we're doing as something that we can do in park area, even though they have other sources, because everybody's got other sources of money. We need to do what's best for habitat in Minnesota. That's our charge, wherever it is, wherever it's most cost-effective and of most benefit. And if it happens to be in a park in a metro area, isn't that great? If it's up in the northwest corner of the state, that's great as well. But it should be based on where habitat is the winner in this. And we need to be very careful in what we do to make sure that we're making those kinds of decisions. Okay?
I almost always regret when they say something. So does Bill. Yeah. But thank you. You know, this, I'm going to just express some of my personal feelings and reflections that have to do with this perceived tension that must have all happened before I got here, because I've never seen anything of it in this council, and I have little to no experience with any legislators or lobbyists other than what goes on during our meetings in these rooms. I was lobbied just once during the last session of our round, and if anything, it worked against the intended lobbyist outcome, I'm sure. And I guess I'm just stubborn enough to think that nobody needs to tell me in such an obvious way that, you know, what my job is. But this whole thing reminded me of being involved with national contract negotiations with U.S. Steel and the steel workers. And, I mean, it's knockdown drag out, and you're up until, you know, all hours for weeks on end, and you come out of it with a product that then you have to go back to work on. And you have to work together, and you have to hold hands. And it's not like it's kumbaya, but you have to work together. And I feel like there's this amorphous animosity that I have no idea where it came from or why it's even there, but people seem to assume things that are in counselors' heads or hearts, and I'm telling you, you don't. And you need to, I think if anything, we need to do is drop the hyperbole and stop the name-calling and sit down and talk. And if it means I'm on the record several times of asking for more meetings or asking for more hearings on more projects, and the more that we do that, the more that we communicate, the better off we're going to be. And we need to communicate with the people who seem to feel that we're not doing what we need to be doing. So I'm committed to do that. And despite whatever the, maybe someday somebody will tell me what all this negative feeling is about, but conservation in the state is good, no matter where it is. It's just a matter of quality. And some is better than others, but none of it is bad. And we all need to keep an open mind, a non-exclusive mind, about everybody inside and outside of this advisory group, which is what we are. So, I mean, I'm committed to come back and say, I don't want to hear about what happened in this session anymore. I want to move forward, and I want to do the best job we can, looking at the Constitution and looking at the science-based conservation plans that are on record and looking at our process. And the more participation, the better. Thanks.
Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to echo Dane's comments, too, but I would disagree with you. There was a winner here. The people of Minnesota won this because it preserved the process. This was never about individual projects. This was about the process. That project were scrutinized and evaluated and either voted up or down. There were a lot of people that came into this room that did not get any money. The parks were part of it. And I'll tell you, now we're sitting around here apologizing for maybe turning down a proposal that was lousy. We don't have to do that. Were there some good things in there? Yeah, I didn't see some of them. Lake Independence probably was a good project. I never saw it. I never voted it up or down. I don't know how that happened. But nevertheless, the process was preserved here. And I too want to thank Governor Dayton for preserving this process because it's critical. We only have so much money. So we have to make priorities, don't we? Well, the parks, Metro Parks proposal fell below the priority. I told a good legislative friend of mine, the park land in the Twin Cities is already preserved. So it's just a matter of time when we want to develop the habitat in there or improve it or whatever needs to be done. But there are a lot of places in Minnesota that aren't preserved, that need to be protected, and need money. We don't have so much money. So we need to consider those first and have a priority list. So the people in Minnesota won this. And I'm not going to apologize for turning down a lousy project.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the one thing I would encourage where we want to label these projects as park projects, I would just really, if you guys get a chance sometime to look at, if you can't go in person and go visit it, look on the map at the Umorn Land by the university. The Dakota County project was in Whitetail Woods. It's an area that will, I would say, have limited hunts. It's adjacent to the WMA. We'll probably have capable partner deer hunts, duck hunts, turkey hunts, all that. You wouldn't call it a park if you were walking in it. You know, recently I was visiting with Dakota County, and he talked about when I was walking in there, I came upon a couple bags of decoys near an unbelievably cool duck slough that's in this park that's called Whitetail Woods. Well, the southern half of that's not going to be developed. It's ideal money for Lassar to spend on. So I think we need to be careful. And Ron, you're right. We saw a synopsis of this proposal. I think the reality was it was put together kind of late in the process. In hindsight, I would have strongly recommended the Metro Parks folks wait to do a better proposal in the next year, which now I'd imagine they're going to do, and we'll really get to look at it. Honestly, I don't know if I knew Whitetail Woods was in the proposal. As you say, you don't know about Lake Independence. And honestly, a year ago, I didn't know that Whitetail Woods was the Butler property that I was instrumental in helping buy in 05 or 06. I never knew that was the name Dakota County put on it. So I think we probably, as much as we do a lot of work with those big, thick, white books, unfortunately, maybe our homework needs to be even a little bit better. But don't think of these, as much as I picked on Theodore Worth and Representative Kahn's own hometown as being the poster child of what I didn't like in this proposal, the vast majority of this proposal probably was really strong. And to Mr. Scherer's comment, I have said all along, the biggest thing we should be worried about is somebody mounting a campaign to get rid of this 3/8 dedicated sales tax. Because what we're spending on the money on is fantastic. We're trying to decide between the fantastic and just a smidgen less than fantastic projects. We get to spend $100 million a year, and we spend it terrifically, I would tell you. And we're doing stuff that people only dreamed about in 08 that we would be doing. And the stuff that we don't fund would be, some of it arguably, just as good as what we do fund. So we need to recognize, and folks, you don't want to do that, but there's a political process here involved. And please be conscious of that political process is really strong. Representative Hansen talked about it a little bit. That's why I really think there'd be value in us meeting and continuing. I don't want us to get political. I don't. I think it's a terrific process, the openness, the scoring, the posting of all that. We need to continue. But I think meeting later on would be beneficial as we recognize the politics change and those of us that have been around a little while saw this movement coming. It was huge, and it didn't surprise me. I was hopeful that we'd get a compromise that would have made a lot of people in this room mad, but I think it would have made some people a little easier this time. So I think it's good discussion, and we need to recognize the politics of this. It's pretty big deal, but boy, it's good money to spend. We're going to see it over the next 2 days.
So, Danny, I think we'll take under advisement when we're looking at our schedule for next year whether or not we ought to meet during the session and have a separate discussion about how often and such. I'm wondering specifically with regard to your comment of you couldn't get to the detail of the proposal. Do we want to provide any guidance to the folks with the Metro Parks in terms of a recommendation to come to us with individual projects or as a whole package so that we are sure we're looking at projects in the most appropriate way? I mean, my own preference would be to send a message back that the best way to look at those projects is not lumped together where they aren't even consistent in habitat type and type of activity, and it would be far better to look at it as individual projects.
Well, I would agree with you that I believe in, of the seven county metropolitan area, Ramsey County and eastern Hennepin County are going to have struggles to really meet our criteria, really, in the really urban area where we're trying to develop habitat, restore, enhance, protect wildlife, and have it open to the taking and fishing game. It's pretty hard for them, and if they put those projects in, I think we're going to have to really evaluate, because one, they can be really expensive to restore, might include soil correction, brownfield sites, whatever. But there's a lot of cool stuff in Anoka County, Washington County. I encouraged my local counties, I represent both Washington and Dakota, to not lump it together. I agree with you, but I talked to the folks after they met with you, and it seemed like they were looking at that option more than when they first approached you, that they felt they should keep it together. And if they do keep it together, I think maybe they could do it separately, and I'm not exactly sure, maybe Mr. Becker could comment how that would be if they actually submitted the proposal, one as a part and one individually. That might be a little problematic, I don't know, but like in the Dakota County ones, there's some really strong proposals. The other thing I told them, some of them were smaller projects, 60,000, Meesville Ravine, it's Trout Brook, Trout Stream. I said, get together with Trout Unlimited, and that's a good conservation at the small grants that Scott worked so hard on. I said, I think that's more appropriate there. So I think they're learning the process.
We did recommend that small projects come through the partners grant process instead of being part of a big one. But
being a former member of LCCMR, and with those grants, we did get packages with coalitions, partnerships, and I found that some of the members found that very helpful. I found it very distracting, and I found it very difficult to wade through all of those, but the numbers were a lot higher for grant proposals than what I understand that you read. So for my personal self, I would much rather see individual projects and projects where you could really see that they were partnering up with other people, that they thought through their very own project. What I'm afraid of with any larger entity is that you end up giving them some money and say, okay, share this with your group. And I don't think you want to lose the control of being able to pick. You don't want to send the money to another political entity. You want to be able to pick those, I think, yourself using the criteria that you have developed. So I would strongly encourage that parks, individual parks, or projects would come from the metro area, written up independently, and that they try to work through as many partners as possible. And I don't know how we facilitate that. Is that something that could be done No, first off, the group really needs to decide if that's the way they want to see the projects and read them independently. But then what would the next step be? Would that be something that would be written up in the request for proposals as criteria?
The request for proposals is out. The deadline is the 14th. So what we could do is send a message to those parks that it is, we would rather see a proposal for individual projects than a lumping of all projects together. They can still do whatever they want. And we have to respond. But, you know, my own sense is a good project is going to have a better opportunity if we see it in the full detail versus as a component of something else. But that's for the group to decide.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to report that 9 a.m. on Friday the 7th, we meet with the Met Council and the members who are interested in submitting in this room to go over these issues, and we'll carry the message as we get it to them and help them do the best job they can until we have our form.
Let me ask a question in another way. Is there anyone here that would be more comfortable seeing something similar to what we saw last year, which is a lumping of all the Metro Parks projects as a single package versus seeing individual projects?
Mr. Chair, I think if there are corridors that cross county boundaries, or if you're dealing with the big river, you're going to be dealing with multiple counties. So when you look at connectivity that may cross a jurisdiction, that's going to require multiple jurisdictions involved. Having an entity with multiple proposals that are not corridors or not connected somehow for the habitat, that's a little different. But you could have a river system that crosses county boundaries that is going to require that there's, it can't be one jurisdiction alone.
And as of yesterday afternoon, there are at least three counties that were submitting or working on proposals, parks and open spaces.
So. Yeah.
David, I just have a question for Representative McNamara. The suggestion that we have meetings later into the session, you know, we've already seen the projects, we've made the decision, so what would we be doing during those meetings, Representative McNamara? I don't quite understand.
Can we do that discussion later? Because we're way behind schedule this morning, and I think that is a discussion that we need to have. If we can just do it later, that would be, you okay with that?
Yep.
Okay. Bill?
Did you hear that? That Bill back.
Real quickly, just let's bring some history back here. The first proposals I remember being very tirelessly, we went through each and every park proposal that was there, and we agreed to do that, and we also agreed not to fund those projects. I think there were individual projects back then. I would certainly strongly suggest if there's any habitat projects that metro or regional parks have, I don't care where they're from, meet the test of the scrutiny of this body as we have everything else, and we've been very successful. You know, it's kind of funny that you know, I keep hearing this and then I'm going to shut up here, but I keep hearing this thing that we need to be scrutinized more so than any other part of the portion of the legacy that we have. We've had, I think, two audits already. There's talk about, I don't know if it's a talk or a threat about having another one. I said, bring it on. Let's do it. I don't understand this this constant looking at Lesage Sands Outdoor Heritage Council and bypassing everybody else. I mean, it doesn't seem like the Board of Arts gets scrutinized near as much as we do. And I brought this up at other meetings. I say if we're doing something wrong, we should be corrected, and there's a process in place to do it. But I think we've been very successful in what we're doing, and we should continue down that path, and I don't think we should be bending for anybody, whether they call them a special interest group or we call them something like coalitions and partnerships, which is more important to me. Special interest group is a term that you use when you don't like some particular area. It's a political term, and sometimes people use it for their for their interests, and frankly, it means nothing to me. So I think what we've been doing is proper, and we should continue on that.
Rick?
I just want to add, we've been talking a lot about the parks, but I think part of the discussion that occurred during the session also looked at the recommendations, and that to have recommendations that are phase three, phase four, you know, and I'm sure they're going to come with phase five. So, and there is discussion that some folks just don't apply anymore, because they know that they don't have a chance. That's a perception. Council members may disagree with that, but it's a real perception. Then why bother? Because it's going to be phase four, phase five, that certain entities are going to continue to get funded. And we won't be spending the amount of time we've just spent on parks, on those tens of millions of dollars. I think we need to realize that. That's part of the whole question. And parks folks, you know, all of your votes on the council are out in public. Your scoring and your ranking is out in public. So they look at the scoring, they look at the ranking. Anybody can, any member of the public can. And there are some patterns that are there. For whatever reason, there are patterns that are there. So I think this is part of the discussion, that we should encourage that anybody can apply, because habitat is important. But we always seem to forget that it's not just habitat. It's protect, restore, and enhance wetlands, forests, and prairies. No matter where they are. It doesn't have a clause that says except in the metro. It doesn't have a clause that says except on tribal land. It says protect, restore, and enhance prairie, wetlands, and forests, and fish, game, wildlife habitat. And if you are purchasing, you can have it be for hunting and fishing as required by law. That means that you can protect in the metro area and allow fishing but not hunting by statute.
Which we did with the arboretum.
Which we did. So there are ways of doing that in session.
Which isn't a park, but we still funded it.
So there, I mean, I think that's important, because I will say special interests. Special interests often always forget the whole clause, because they have clients. Our responsibilities to the public.
For that, because I was going to make the same point. The Constitution isn't just about habitat that you can hunt on. It is about acquisition for lands. Has to be hunt and fishable unless prohibited by law. But habitat can happen anywhere and be restored and enhanced. Jane?
Sorry to continue this discussion, but my understanding, I have to respond to something Representative Hansen brought up. My understanding is there's no correlation in any of the scoring that we've done. And I would want to know if there is any. And I challenge somebody to point it out. I think that's a false statement. And I also would say that people who blame others for not getting funding ought to get back to work, sharpen their pencils, and do a better job. And if you don't wet a line, you're not going to catch a fish. So get busy.
No, Mr. Chair, the member of the legislature lying in a legislative body is quite a step.
I'm going to not get into that. There's a difference of opinion. So, I'm wondering, Representative Kahn, do you want to say anything before we move on? Welcome. Thank you for being here.
I was actually going to work with the public comment session, but that was my role.
Oh, would you like to wait?
I will say one thing. There was something in the legacy bill that Mr. Becker helped us do and that got omitted by mistake in the last assembly of things, and that was a request for when a project is turn down statement of reasons to the proposer of the project. That was Mr. Becker who gave you the, define the language that was in the House bill that didn't make it to the Congress. And I think that would be very helpful. It's certainly helpful for me to come to this meeting. You know, I have, I understand the issue about habitat in the metropolitan area. I'm not asking anyone to protect this group, to protect the habitat in the park that happens to be next to my house, which harbored the fox that killed one of our pet geese, which happens to be half a mile from downtown Minneapolis. So there is habitat in all kinds of places that you don't see. But I think that would be very helpful. I think the idea of meeting, you know, during the legislative session to reform projects after a conversation with the legislature would also be helpful. Just change. Attitudes change. One of the points I've made at is that the House position on going with the House position was so strong that the person who was proposing an amendment to go back to the original LSOHC didn't even want to have a vote on it because he knew by what margin it would be. So, you know, the legislature, the Constitution does say that appropriations are made by the legislature, and I think that people have to be aware of that. And I do think that more continuing conversations with all the voters. I think that one section that we left out is a very important section.
I see nothing wrong, whether it's in the language or not, with good, solid feedback from the voters so that they can understand why there was interest or not interest in our project, and if they're interested, come back, having addressed those issues. Or leave knowing what they did that wasn't of interest.
And this antagonism of the Metropolitan Council or the concept of Metropolitan Regional Parks is a little surprising. I guess I'm the only one around who's, at least in the legislature, when the Metropolitan Regional Parks proposal was proposed and was considered to be that it was done to be the moral equivalent of the state park. And in fact, the language that was incorporated into the legacy bill that deals with regional parks was pretty much taken from the same kind of process that the Metropolitan Parks process uses. So, you know, there is, and I don't see anything in the, you know, I was on LCMR for years and chaired it for two biennia at least, and one of the things that we were very able to do was pull out parts of projects we wanted to fund and start the ones that we didn't fund. So I don't understand why that's a problem. Thank you for the opportunity.
Great, thank you. I'm sure we'll have more discussion. For those of you who are waiting to present to us, I apologize for doing what I almost never do, which is let things run so long and get behind schedule, but I think this is an important discussion for us to have. So, Bill, do you have anything you want to add before we move on?
I just want to say that our recommendations were treated with respect and were implemented in all bills in whole. There was more than that done, but I think we need the tip of the hat to making solid, to the council for making solid recommendations, and for the House and the Senate for recognizing that they were solid recommendations. I grew up in a house where the saying was, good, better, best. Do not let it rest until the good is better and the better is the best. And I think that that's what we have to do here on this council, to make our process and our recommendations the best as possible.
What? Just needed to be squeezed.
And I wanted to just once again reiterate that the proposal system is open now. It closes the 14th. If you need help, if you're in the audience and want assistance, staff is happy to provide assistance, and we'll walk you through your proposal and the system and how to get it in. Thank you.
I see we have a new schedule in front of us, which is really the schedule you should pay attention to. The other one was from a couple of years ago by error, so look at the color one, throw away the other one. With that, I'd like to have Olivia Levine and Tony Sullivan come up and talk a little bit about climate change. Heather, do you want to provide any background to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the council. This is a report that would be something released, and I thought that would be really helpful for us to have an overview of the report. And I asked Tony and Olivia to come and make that presentation. As we know, many of the habitats in our state are in a change system currently, and we anticipate that to continue. So it would be helpful for us to really have a good grounding and understanding of what the impacts might be as we prepare to review proposals for this next year and make our recommendations. So with that, I'll turn it over to Olivia and Tony, and thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss the National Fish and Wildlife Plans Adaptation Strategy with you. So you have a highlight in front of you. If you don't, there's another copy here. Tony Sullivan from Fish and Wildlife Service, and I will be tag teaming. Again, my name is Olivia Levine. I'm with DNR in the Division of Fish and Wildlife. I'm one of the staff members that works both within the department as well as with other state and federal agencies to develop a coordinated, effective response to climate change. I realize we have a very busy day ahead of you, so we're going to go as quickly as possible and concisely through the strategy and talk about how it might influence our response within the events. So just to get to the summary of the discussion today, a lot of what you're doing is reflected in the strategy. So there won't be any, there are going to be few surprises for you because you're so involved in land acquisition corridors, etc., that are going to be reflected in this report. We're all working to ensure that habitats and systems are resilient. That's one of the principles of this work. And thinking about how you can incorporate elements of the strategy to create durable projects for the long term. So just quickly, what do we mean by adaptation? You're probably familiar with mitigation, where we're talking about sequestering carbon or reducing emissions. For adaptation, here's an example of the Great Lakes whitefish fishery. So we're expecting changes in the abundance, perhaps increase in whitefish and changes in the distribution. An adaptation response would be how do we change regulations in whitefish to reflect those increases or changes in the distribution. That would be an adaptation strategy. And that's a specific one targeted for a particular species. A lot within this report is more general. So we can develop targeted adaptation strategies, but we can also talk more specifically or more generally about strategies that would benefit a range of species. And just going quickly to these next steps, again, in the interest of time, is that it's an issue for the present. We're seeing changes currently. And I refer you to the National Climate Assessment that the federal government put this year for more information on what we've seen in the past 50 years on changes in climate, what we expect to see, how it's impacting various sectors. That we are seeing warming in air temperatures, sea temperatures, that if we're also seeing changes in snow cover, humidity, heavy precipitation events. We're seeing a lot of those changes in Minnesota and the Midwest. But the changes vary across regions as well as seasons. We're seeing a lot of warming in winter. We're seeing a lot of our precipitation increases in the warm seasons. Wildlife can be directly impacted by climate change, so we might see loss of nests to storms and flooding, as we've seen those, or drought conditions impacting waterfowl production. We're also seeing changes in the interactions between species. So disease is something that we're very concerned with. Avian botulism is an example. The bacteria do really well in warm temperatures and shallow waters. They can cause great die-offs in waterfowl and water birds. So increasingly concerned about diseases under climate change. And also changes in plant communities and habitat. So seeing changes in aspen distribution in Minnesota, loss of aspen due to drought, insects, and temperature and precipitation, so those interacting factors. Or changes in invasive species. So we're seeing some species that are no longer killed off by minimum winter temperature. So kudzu expanding into Illinois over the past few decades and projected to expand into Wisconsin by 2020.
Okay, I'd like to say we'll tag team it a little bit here. I'm Tony Sullins. I'm with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I am based here in Minnesota. My field office is primarily charged with implementing the Endangered Species Act in Minnesota. In that capacity, I've met with some of you over the years. And I've also been familiar with work, some of the work of this council, and continually amazed at the high-quality projects that you recommend. And I can only imagine how difficult some of these project decisions are, recommendation decisions are for you. And I can relate to how confusing and difficult it might be to wonder if and how you should incorporate climate change concerns or considerations into your thought process. It's something that my office struggles with every day. We list species, put them on the endangered species list, try to recover them, try to gauge what, if any, impact is attributable to climate change, and then what to do about it. So this strategy document, this climate adaptation strategy, I believe is a helpful tool should you choose to use it. I believe I was asked to come here today for many reasons. But one reason is that I was not involved in creating this strategy. But I'm one of the many field generals in the service that's charged with trying to use it and determine whether it makes sense. And I'm getting a little experience. It's very new, but I think there are some things that in that document that are helpful. So a little history. I only have about 9 slides, and my presentation should only take about 10 minutes. But this strategy arose out of several calls for action back in 2009 and 2010. Congress and appropriations bill basically directed the administration to develop a national government-wide strategy to address climate impacts on fish, wildlife, and plants. The administration, around the same time, called for the strategy. Many stakeholders, non-federal and non-governmental stakeholders, also called for the same kind of approach. And so a steering committee was put together involving 15 federal agencies, 5 states. I believe the state of Wisconsin was co-chair steering committee, management team involving numerous federal agencies, 90-plus researchers. Again, I was not involved directly in creating this document, but I was told that, speaking to those who were involved in it, that it was really an absolute model of collaboration among tribal, state, and governmental entities at every level. The folks who were involved in it are very proud of the process, and I believe they created something that's usable for us. So, I guess quickly, what is this thing, this climate adaptation strategy? It's a framework for coordinated action by multiple partners to reduce the risks and impacts of climate change on natural resources and the people that depend on it. There are a few things that it's not. It's not a set of requirements or mandates. You can use this document or not. You can take it or leave it. You can use parts of it, all of it. It's really up to you. It's also not a strategy to halt or slow the rate of climate change. It's just a recognition of the reality that some things are changing out there and that we're going to have to figure out how to adapt to that. Those of us who manage, who have the privilege of managing fish and wildlife resources and lands, are going to have to figure out some way of adapting to that. So the purpose of this is to give us tools to enable natural resource administrators, officials, and other decision makers like many of you to take action to adapt to changing climate. It's a statement that we're not helpless in the face of some impending doom, but it's a very American strategy. In the face of a tremendous challenge, we don't bury our heads in our hands, and we don't lament that nothing can be done, but we try to act in a sensible and thoughtful way when opportunities present themselves. So again, this is for all federal, state, and tribal resource decision makers, non-governmental decision makers, the people who come to this body with projects and proposals, can find some tools in this document. As Olivia mentioned, we have a highlights document that I believe everyone had. It's very helpful. There's also a 150-page full document online that has a lot of good information and is very, very user-friendly. The way this strategy is organized is that the drafters determined that there were 7 very meaningful goals to try to help fish, wildlife, and plants adapt to changing climate. And I put them on the screen here. And obviously, I won't go through them one at a time. Each of these 7 goals is discussed in detail in the strategy. And then for each of those goals, the authors developed specific strategies in the neighborhood of 4, 5, 6, or 7 strategies to implement that particular goal. And then they took it another step down and said that with each of those strategies, there are some action items that might be appropriate case by case, sort of a menu of things to choose from, if you're in a position that you want to try to address climate change impacts on wildlife. So as I said, I don't have the time, probably wouldn't be helpful to go through all 7 of these anyway, but I did want to highlight goal number 1, which seems a particular fitting of the mission of the council and my agency as well. And that is the goal of conserving and connecting capital. And again, this is against the backdrop of potential impacts of climate change on fish and wildlife habitat. So on the slide, on the overhead, 4 strategies are laid out that were determined appropriate and meaningful to help conserve and connect habitat in a way that assists species in climate change adaptation. Look at strategy number 1, for example. Identify key areas needed for ecologically connected habitat networks that are resilient to climate change. This is something that we see throughout the document, is that the best available science out there indicates that one important thing you can do is to connect habitat, to minimize the extent to which we have isolated or fragmented blocks that are potentially more vulnerable to habitat, is the wildlife is usually more vulnerable. To the fullest extent possible, that we connect corridors connecting these habitats, then we allow for movement so that animals, particularly, can respond to warming temperatures and changes in climatic conditions by simply moving around through the habitat from one unit or block to the other. And so, one of the specific action items for this strategy is to identify lands that are currently experiencing climate stress. And once we know where they are, we can make those a high priority for protecting some time. Another thing that's recommended, in addition to connectivity, connecting various units, is to protect a wide array of habitat types and subtypes for particular species. To not put all our eggs in one basket. And a quick Minnesota example. My office right now is undergoing a review of 2 prairie butterfly species to determine whether they should be listed under the endangered species. And one of them is difficult to skip. This species exists as a butterfly in its adult form for about a week to 10 days out of the year. And the rest of the year, it's in larval or egg form. So it's got a week to 10 days, and during that time, as an adult, it has to have nectar plants, purple palm flowers, That's a very delicate, precarious balance, and they window. And if something does happen that throws off the timing of the bloom of those purple coneflower other nectar cones, you've got problems. And that can be very localized, very specific, depending on local hydrologic conditions, shade, north slopes, south slopes, soil type management. And so what we believe we need to do is try to acquire or protect different examples of Dakota skipper habitat throughout the Great Plains. Not to protect all Dakota skipper habitat in one part of the range, in one block, but to try to get representative samples of different types of habitat that these species need and exist on, I should say. So that's an example of something that would be consistent with this strategy. The strategy is very action-oriented, and the specific strategies and action items that are identified in there were selected because it was thought that they could be implemented in a 5-10 year time horizon, and that they were reasonable short-term actions that people could take if they chose to try to address climate change impacts on fish and wildlife. There are key roles for these regional collaboratives, and that is an important part of this, is that this is a global and national problem. And the greater the extent we can work together with people on a broad landscape scale, we believe we'll have a better chance of success. And there are key roles for the state wildlife action plan, tribal resource management, big picture thinking is very important. It's going to require a very broad-based effort in many cases to make a difference. And the last slide, just an important note from the strategy itself, is that the intent of this thing was to develop some shared solutions to protect shared values. That's what this thing is about. And that's all I have for now. I'll turn it back over to Lydia.
So then if I could take the last few minutes and go through each of those goals and talk about specific Minnesota examples. We are beginning the work. We are working together, but there's still a lot more to be done. So for goal one, so for conserving and connecting habitat, the prairie plan is an excellent example of selecting large core areas that can support a diversity of species, corridors that allow movement of species that need to move to more suitable conditions in the future. Very excellent example of that. Managing species and habitat. So the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies recommends that management plans guide and direct a lot of our work for particular species, and it's very important to start integrating climate change into management plans. So they developed guidance, working with state and federal agencies, to integrate climate change into state wildlife action plans. And so across the nation, state wildlife action plans are now integrating climate change considerations for each species, or the majority species, into their management. So enhancing management capacity. So one of the important things is that working together is really important. We're all facing a similar challenge. Some of our tools that we've traditionally used may no longer work. One example is prescribed fire. So we're seeing more rain in the warm seasons, right, when we might want to do burns. Are there other tools that we can use for grassland management, for prairie management, or for forest management? Let's share that information. Let's share those experiences. Let's work together. So the Climate Change Response Framework, which is a partnership with U.S. Forest Service, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, as well as nonprofit organizations like the Nature Conservancy. Let's share these tools. Let's develop common pilot projects so we can inform our understanding and make better management decisions. Adaptive management. The idea is that we monitor what we're doing. So one example is the Sustaining Lakes in the Changing Environment Project, where we're collecting biological and chemical indicators on lakes that are exemplary for the state of Minnesota. How are they changing? And the idea is that if we have a long-term data set that we can start picking out pieces of what's driving the change and use that to inform our management decisions. So once we can identify the problem, we can develop a more effective management solution. We also have shared information needs, you know, with Wisconsin, with Michigan. We have common resources, common problems. So one issue is, well, how is climate change going to impact the state of Minnesota? Can we get better climate models? So Fish and Wildlife Service developed landscape conservation cooperatives in partnership with state agencies, federal agencies, nonprofits to say, what are our common information needs? Let's fund those. Let's share that information. So, and one example is better climate data at a resolution that will more accurately inform natural resource management. Increasing awareness and motivating action. So a lot of you might be familiar with Seasons In and Beyond Seasons In, partnerships with Trout Unlimited, Ducks Unlimited, and other organizations to share information with stakeholders to build public support on how climate change is impacting resources and how we might more effectively respond. And there are many other examples of that. And the last goal of reducing non-climate stressors, when organisms are physiologically stressed, when they're competing for light, competing for resources, it's much more harder for them to respond to the additional stress of increased temperatures that climate change brings. So that's why we focus on reducing those non-climate stressors, so that physiologically they can more easily cope with the additional threat of climate change. Again, we are focusing on habitat and systems that are resilient to climate change. What does that mean? Again, they can adapt to change and other stressors. They can continue to support wildlife, plants, and people. And they're flexible. They can respond. They can use their own resources, behavior, genetics, to respond to those changes. So how might the strategy inform decision-making? So where relevant, organizations are starting to incorporate climate change considerations into their grant allocation. So where relevant, you might incorporate elements of the strategy to create projects that are durable in the long term. And again, some of these strategies are more relevant than others for the work that you do. And then just direct you to additional resources. As Tony said, the strategy has a lot more detail. On the website, there are also short videos that are available. You have the brochure, and then also the National Climate Assessment that the federal government has put together has information on specific resource sectors that you might be interested in as well.
I saw one of the earlier slides that had North America different impacts, like 46% over the upper Midwest. Does that suggest that the continental climate is the most susceptible to the greatest variation, and it's even more so with climate change? But there was I think there was one earlier. That one, yeah. Well, Northeast part of the country too. What does that one mean?
So this is
that's heavy precipitation.
Heavy precipitation.
Okay.
And so for each factor that you might be interested in, which would be minimum temperature, heavy precipitation, the patterns are different across the states.
Right. And then I want to follow up. Does any of this information that you have now, do you think it is sufficient that it would affect our 25-year conservation plans or any of the other major conservation plans that we look to in making our decisions?
No.
It pertains to the climate information or the strategy itself?
Either. Yeah.
So,
what do we take from this to do our job?
So,
well, just a quick thought. One of the recommendations in the strategy is to examine existing plans and determine whether there need to be amendments, modifications, and take into account the projected climate changes as the available data.
Excellent presentation. Is this mostly as we look at corridors? Are we looking pretty much at north-south movement, or have they noticed some east-west type of movements within the range?
Yes. so I can respond to that one. So in the in one of the most comprehensive studies that I've seen to date, it was actually in Australia, it's published in Nature this year. And although there are some movements that are northwest by some species, it's not necessarily just in that direction because it's about the interaction between temperature as well as moisture. And so some species are responding northwest and some are responding in different directions.
So go to your slide for goal one with this question for short list. So, and I'm a huge fan of corridors, but I'm confused with this and have been and actually had a discussion in California with someone who's doing a lot of work on old growth forests on Sunday night. I was there because they're worrying about corridors as well. And the question is, what are we expecting in terms of animals to move on these corridors that we want to protect? The plants aren't going to move fast enough, and the insects probably aren't going to move fast enough. And the animals seem to go, they like a corridor, but this is, most of the corridors you're pointing out here are pretty well undeveloped now. So I'm confused with this corridor concept as to what the actual gain is to us and what we're trying to protect. And I don't mean this in a critical way, it's a confused way. Because it seems like the deer are going to move north or south, east or west, and get there. And, you know, there was a mountain lion in St. Paul this week. It's not going to need a corridor to get to habitat it can live in. So can you help me understand what I truly have been confused about in terms of the true value of corridors from an animal standpoint and if I'm missing something?
Mr. Chairman, I can start with maybe one specific example, if she has some bigger picture thinking to add to this. It's back to the butterfly species that I mentioned as an example. We've learned that when the ghost skipper hatches and is in its adult phase for that week to 2 weeks, it won't move more than a kilometer across unsuitable habitat. So if you've got a cornfield greater than a kilometer separating two perfectly beautiful native prairie remnants, even marlins, that butterfly is trapped in the unit that it occupies. So that's one of the species-specific examples where you can restore that connection and you can open up, depending on the actual situation, potentially, you know, vast amounts of additional habitat for an entire species.
So, just to follow up, the current habitat of that butterfly with climate change is going to be make it inhospitable to the butterfly?
We're fearful that it will in some of the prairie remnants right now here. Well, first of all, the butterfly has disappeared recently from many of the prairie remnants that it previously occupied for unknown reasons. Second, there's some evidence that changes in humidity in the cup layer in the prairie is basically causing the larval form caterpillars to dry up or the eggs to not hatch. And we don't have conclusive science on any of this. That's guessing, it's some speculation.
So what you're really telling me is nobody's sure, but it's better to have the corridor than not have the corridor.
That seems to be our best conclusion right now. That in many cases, not always, not only the corridor for corridor's sake, but in many cases we can come to a likely benefit to fish and wildlife. We open up lots of habitat and we will isolate. Now, another thing is genetic isolation. That's another important reason to have this movement between various isolated populations, if you will, to not isolate them so that we can have that genetic, that inbreeding, for good genetic health.
So, Mr. Chair, if I might add, so another piece would be the diversity of habitat that might be opened up with the corridors. So we might have one unit that might be more susceptible to drought than one another unit that might be more shaded. And so, an example would be a different butterfly, the crimson butterfly. So if there's some woodland that is protected by shade, then the larva can feed on that. And so if it's connected by a corridor to more open grass, then you might have more.
Yeah.
David, I just have a quick question. Could you give us an example of maybe one of the changes in protocol that the DNR or the Fish and Wildlife Service has made that in restoring or enhancing or protecting, doing some of the things that we do here as an example of something that we might consider or look into?
I can give one example, and it's in the Endangered Species Act implementation area. We developed a protocol for analyzing each listing determination and each critical habitat designation process of analyzing the climate change impacts to the extent we can understand, up to the extent there's any data on that particular species. So we make a determined effort to analyze those potential impacts and to address them. And again, to keep coming back to the butterfly, it's a good example to use. Our protocol now would be to try to designate critical habitat in a broad array of habitat types to attempt to shield that species from the potential catastrophic impacts of climate change. If we only protected one type of habitat and that habitat was lost through warming or changes in precipitation. So that's one protocol, if you will. Through our endangered species listing and critical habitat designation process, we consider trying to address climate change.
Bill?
Mr. Chair, and question be directed to the DNR. Ms. Lee, if you've reviewed our projects, I think you may have said that, our projects over the years that we have put out funded here, do they go hand in hand with the mind climate change? Is it something that we're doing? Are we doing things properly here? Do you think there's some things that we could improve on? And then I have some questions with regards to the document.
Okay, with that, the one caveat that I'm relatively new to the DNR and haven't reviewed all of the projects that you all have funded. On a program or project basis, there might be individuals that incorporate elements of climate considerations to the projects, but there's no systemic process for doing that. So on a project basis, potentially, yes.
And the other question, Mr. Chair. On page 9 of the smaller document here, the forest, wetland, prairie systems, could you explain to me the seed dispersal here? 11 known species are actually migrating 6 miles north for decades. Can you tell me how that happens? Is our prevailing winds actually changing because of climate change? Is that how the seed dispersion is talking about? Page 9, under forest, wetland, and prairie systems.
This in
the highlights document?
There's
a two-page executive summary, Climate Change and Renewable Energy Management Foundation.
7B.
That's right. Yeah, 7B. Agenda 7B, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, the management
office. Yeah, page 9, and it starts under forest, wetland, and prairie systems. The seed dispersal there, through seed dispersal, the rate's approaching 6 miles per decade. How does that happen?
Not specifically to that example, but for my familiarity with pre-dispersal, so be natural dispersal. So if we look at paleoclimate, so thousands of years ago, a movement of tree species actually occurred at a rate faster than we anticipated, and through natural dispersal, so animals, wind, etc.
So we have it on record that we're moving on an average of 6 miles per decade. Is that correct, according to the?
I'm not sure the source for that study, for that figure, but I know that both historically, again, paleoclimate, as well as projection, that we do know that tree species can relatively quickly across the landscape.
And my last question is something that we probably have just recently here emailed to some back and forth that have been reading such a moose population. We're trying to address that through some habitat projects here. And is it your feeling, or the DNR feeling, that climate change is affecting the moose population more so than predation? Can you talk about that a little bit?
I know that we are working to identify the causal mechanisms for the decline. So for any species, so there's a great interest in the impact of climate change or any one particular species. And when we're talking about climate, we're talking about something that's happening over 3 to 30 years. And so to begin to think about the direct impacts, so be it heat stress or be it water stress, versus the indirect impacts, so changes in habitat. So you begin to tease out those mechanisms and to pinpoint the source. We need quite a bit of information, and it has to be high quality, and we do have to gather it for a long time. And I know that there's a bit of frustration that research will say, well, we need more information to identify the cause. But that's the subject of research, that's the subject of discussion. And for any species, it would be the same answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more quick question, if I could. So you certainly wouldn't rule out the evidence of another state, such as Maine. Maine, for instance, is, and I got this information at the DNR roundtable last year, the year before, and they were talking about the decline of moose. And they have a very similar habitat that we have in the northern forest, and where our moose generally hang out. And they have an abundance of moose there, an overabundance of moose, and no gray wolf. So is that information at all useful to you, or is there any reason why? Do you use that information when you put together your data?
So it's one piece of information. In addition, how climate change impacts disease dynamics would be another piece of information, or how what microclimates are available in wetlands and forest systems. So it's one piece of information that goes along with a suite of other factors.
Mr. Chair, so if we're in the transition zone, forest, and we're doing a restoration, your advice would be to have a broad mix of, let's say, it's clear, so you have the adaptability for that restoration. We're going to be clearing out thistles and other things. The planting should take into account that zone is probably moving it. Or if we're purchasing something for a unique feature in the transition zone, that feature may move outside of the purchase for the time, so it's a permanent protection.
Yes, Representative Hanson, that reminded me of a concept that's contained in the strategy. I had never heard of it recently. I think the term was rolling easements. It seems like that might be one adaptation strategy to address that very scenario where we might have changing habitats. We might acquire an easement today that in 10 years is not expected to contain the habitat for the species that we buy land for. So we plan ahead to have perhaps option agreements in place to obtain easements along the migration or movement corridor of that species.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, then taking it outside of the transition zones, but maybe to the southwest corner of the state, where if we look at the precipitation from the southwest corner to the southeast corner, you have quite a range. But if you're planting something on a restoration, or if you're purchasing something that has a microclimate, certain rainfall and a certain temperature, but all of a sudden, over 50 years, that becomes like Kansas instead of Rock County. You would have to be looking at flexibility, planting, or that type of thing, because we're going to be looking at, you know, precipitation and temperature.
And I would say just one of the other considerations are, what are the multiple benefits? So the buffers are not selecting necessarily for one thing, but what are additional benefits that would be garnered from that selection?
So then we should be looking at more holistic outcomes rather than single species.
Yes, that is highly recommended. Possible. The investment in these lands where you may not have the returns. That's something that the Fish and Wildlife Service we're trying to learn how to factor in, is that if we're going to buy part of a particular piece of land for our acquisition or easement or protection, we may only expect 5 or 10 years of return on our investment, based upon climate models and projected changes in the landscape. And there may be times when that's not an investment that we want to make. There may be times when we're going to use help.
Any other questions?
Great. Thank you for coming in. Thank you.
Very simple.
Next on our agenda, discussion on conservation easements. Done by the legislative auditor. You have a report in front of you evaluating conservation easements.
Chairman, while they just set up Chairman and members of the town hall, this is what you have on the ground meeting, and that's a lot of the folks that you know from the dark, you know, and verify the audio, but they remind you that the Office of the Legislative Auditor is the auditor of state government. We do audit, we do financial audits, we also do investigations, and we do evaluations. And we have been years of the legacy and money to apply our tools and our mission to ensure that the legacy money from all four funds are being used appropriately, consistent with the law, and that we are achieving the tools that we have, the impact and the legacy that the people of the state and so want us to achieve. Mr. Chairman and members, we have felt a very close collaboration with this council over the years, and even when you are not meeting and we are not sitting in front of you, we are often meeting with your staff and feel that we have a very close and productive relationship with them. And that has led to the evaluation that we have in front of you today. Now, let me just remind you that the Office of the Legislative Auditor is always working in the area of natural resources. We do a lot of things, a lot of work at the DNR, PCA, Bowser. And we are currently, in fact, over at DNR looking at an issue that we have discussed over the years a good deal with you and other people concerned with legacy money, and that is how much of the department's overhead and administrative costs are being rolled into the charges against legacy money, particularly outdoor heritage money. And so that report will be coming to you, and that will be a continuing focus of our concern, because I think we've learned over the years through talking to you, talking to others, that to the degree possible, we really want this new legacy money to be used and built upon the resources that are already there, and not too much of it that to be absorbed into just overhead administrative costs. I'll just mention two other evaluations that we did that I think kind of fill out the context of why we're here today. We did an overall evaluation and issued a report in 2011 on the legacy amendment, all four funds, and how the legislature had structured the input for the recommendations including a review of this council. And I think, as Mr. Becker reminds people from time to time, I think quite appropriately, we said some quite positive things about the level of oversight and thoughtfulness that this council gives to its responsibilities. We also did an evaluation of natural resource land and issued that report in 2010. And I think that was the report more than any other that really led to this one, because that report had a chapter on easements. And I felt at the time that we had just delved into an issue that needed more attention, because easements are really an important and growing new tool for use by the state. And I think easements are particularly noteworthy because in that evaluation that we did of natural resource land, we said that the state was at the point where we had already acquired so much land that we really didn't have the resources to adequately manage it. And so, although we're going to work on that, getting more resources for managing the land that we have, that we acquire in fee, we also think that this tool of conservation easements presents an alternative. Both approaches, acquisition and easements, have their advantages and disadvantages. But clearly, easements have the advantage that property stays on the tax rolls, and there is an agreement that there will be management, not just by the state, but by the people who continue to own the land. And so it is a very advantageous tool to be used. And we are now into a pretty significant investment in conservation easements. And what I think this report is going to tell you is that we need to keep working on the standards and expectations we have when we make those investments. It seems like the investments maybe got a little ahead of, particularly at DNR, of some of the resources and standards that we had for protecting those investments. And so we laid out in this report not really blockbuster criticisms, but really just some findings that we think could lead to some modifications and improvement. And if we are about ready for Ms. Randall's presentation, she's going to tell us what those findings and recommendations are. Correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Mitchell, for trying to stall as long as possible. But I'm just going to dive in, and hopefully the slides will catch up soon. So as I believe Mr. Noble said, we released this report to the legislature in February of this year, and we're happy to be here today to discuss it with you. So if you just want to follow along on the handout, and the slides will catch up when we get there. You know, the bottom line, as Mr. Noble said, is there's no huge problems, no blockbuster findings, but we did find a number of opportunities to improve accountability and oversight and maybe work. Yay! Thank you very much. But let me jump first to kind of some of the key findings I'm going to talk about today. So the first one is that nonprofit organizations, which are significant partners with the state for state funded conservation movement, these organizations are given a lot of latitude to acquire conservation easements and negotiate the easement agreements. We also found that the requirements in state law for monitoring easements are not adequate. We also found that easement holders don't regularly measure the outcomes of the easements really beyond the number of acres protected. And finally, funding for stewardship, which involves the monitoring and enforcing of a conservation easement, that funding really varies by easement holder and easement type, and that could have an effect ultimately on the type of stewardship provided. So these are the main findings I'm going to focus the presentation on. But first, I'm going to just take a step back, provide an overview of conservation easements. I know you're a knowledgeable group, but I think sometimes it helps just to make sure we're all on the same page. And so, as you know, conservation easements are a land protection tool, kind of similar to public ownership, except, as Mr. Mills noted, the ownership remains in the private landowner's hands, which means it stays on the tax rolls. And there is, as again, as Mr. Mills said, the landowner there who's responsible for managing that land. An easement agreement is a voluntary agreement that limits the use of the land. So, for example, may limit the ability to build a structure on the land, or farm the land, or mine the land. In Minnesota, there are four primary holders of state-funded conservation easements. two state agencies, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, BOWSER, and the Department of Natural Resources, DNR. And then there are two nonprofit organizations, Ducks Unlimited and Minnesota Land Trust, that also hold a significant number of state-funded conservation easements, although a much smaller share than the state agencies. So BOWSER holds about 80% of the state-funded conservation easements in the state. The two nonprofit organizations together hold 2% of the state-funded conservation easements in the state. From 2001 to 2011, the state spent about $190 million to acquire and restore conservation easements. And currently, there's about 6,600 state-funded conservation easements that protect about 600,000 acres of land in Minnesota. The number of conservation easements in the state more than doubled between 2001 to 2011, and we anticipate that growth to continue, in part because of the Elkhorn Heritage money and the other funds in the legacy from the legacy amendment. Now, this may be redundant for you, but I just like to, I have the slide, I think it's just a fun slide, but I like to walk us through my bundle of sticks just to make sure we all are on the same page with conservation easements. So, you know, oftentimes landowners' rights are referred to as kind of a proverbial bundle of sticks where each right is represented by a different stick. So one stick would represent the right to build a structure, one stick is the right to farm, one is to mine, one is to sell the property, etc. When an easement is acquired, the landowner still keeps some of his or her sticks, but some of those sticks are permanently removed from the bundle. Well, they're permanently removed if it's a perpetual easement, which, by the way, about 96% of the state-funded conservation easements are perpetual. So the conservation easement is said to run with the land, which means it stays with the land regardless of whether ownership changes. So in this example, I've got, you know, three sticks that were removed, so that means perhaps the right to build is forever removed from that land, or the right to farm is forever removed to the land, from the land. But the landowner still retains a number of rights associated with the land, in particular, and noteworthy, the right to sell the property. In Minnesota, there are more than 15 different types of conservation easements, and they each have a different purpose. I know there's a ton of information on this slide. Really, the point is to show you that there's a lot of different types of easements. On page 7 in the report, we list all 15 types and provide an example or an explanation of their purposes. I'm just going to highlight two here just to, again, demonstrate the differences among the easements. So one of them, reinvested in Minnesota, the Rim Reserve easements, which I know you're all familiar with. Their purpose is to restore marginal agricultural land. These easements are typically held by Bowser. And as you know, usually the terms of the easement agreement are that the landowner stops farming that land, and then there's typically restoration done to that property to help restore it back to its natural land and the state. So that's in contrast, for example, to the Wild and Scenic River Conservation easements. These are easements held by DNR. And these easements are on property located along the designated wild and scenic rivers in the state. And the purpose of these easements is simply to protect the natural characteristic of that land. So there's not restoration that occurs through those easements typically. Instead, it's protecting the scenic or recreational characteristics of the property that already exists. So that is my quick overview of conservation easements in Minnesota, just to give us some background. When we set out to do this evaluation, we established a set of what we call minimum consensus standards. And they were standards based on federal organizations, state organizations, nonprofit organizations, organizations in the state that hold conservation easements, looking at the standards they have in practice. And then we developed from them a consensus set of standards that run through the whole life cycle of a conservation easement, all the way from property selection down to enforcement and making amendments and termination of the easement agreements if necessary. Exhibit 1.10, which is on page 21 of the report, provides all the detail behind those standards. We use these standards then to evaluate 127 state-funded conservation easements that were held by those four easement holders, again, Bowser, DNR, Ducks Unlimited, and Minnesota Land Trust. So now let me get to those findings that I started off with in the beginning. So our first key finding is that nonprofit organizations are given a lot of latitude to acquire conservation easements. So the first point here is that nonprofit organizations are, of course, separate organizations from the state. They have their own missions and their own priorities. Oftentimes they line up with the state, but sometimes they may not. And these organizations, again, are given a lot of discretion to identify property, to place on a conservation easement.
good grammar, but hopefully everyone followed me there. But they're also given a lot of discretion to negotiate the terms of the easement agreement. Additionally, the appropriations language that the legislature passed has been pretty broad, which gives these organizations even more discretion. So the 2012 legislature appropriated more than $900,000 to Minnesota Land Trust for this purpose, which is on the slide, to acquire interest in land in fee or permanent conservation easements to restore and enhance natural systems associated with the Mississippi, Minnesota, and St. Croix Rivers. So that covers most of the state, right? And there's not a lot of indication there in terms of what the programmatic objectives are or what outcomes the legislature is hoping to accomplish with that appropriation. And then finally, there's limited state approval of the selection of the easement property or of the easement agreements themselves. So staff of your council and staff of the LCCMR don't have the authority or, frankly, really the expertise to review and approve easement agreements. DNR and Bowser staff may have the expertise to review and approve those easement agreements, but they don't have the authority to do so. So again, in the end, the nonprofit organizations have a lot of discretion in using the state money to acquire state-funded conservation easement. So we have some recommendations regarding oversight. First, it's to the legislature to ensure that appropriations for easements include clear programmatic objectives of what they're hoping to accomplish with that funding. Secondly, we recommend that the legislature require Bowser or DNR, whichever one is serving as the fiscal agent for the appropriations, to review and approve easement agreements with substantial state investment. Now, we're not making this recommendation because we found a lot of problems. We're making this recommendation because, again, it's a significant public investment, and we think it warrants some public oversight. We also are making the recommendation so that we don't have problems in the future. You know, we don't have problems, really big problems so far. Let's keep it that way. Finally, we recommend that the legislature require those nonprofit organizations that hold state-funded conservation easements to be accredited. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Land Trust Accreditation Commission. They're kind of the gold standard out there for conservation easement holding organizations, and they have a pretty rigorous accreditation process. Happily, MLT, Invest Unlimited, are already accredited by this organization. Actually, the Nature Conservancy is also. So this recommendation does not really change things for the key nonprofit organizations that are already holding a lot of state-funded conservation easements. However, it would establish a pretty high bar for any new nonprofit organizations that aren't currently accredited that want to start partnering with the state on state-funded conservation easements. We move on to our next set of findings, which is regarding monitoring. So as you know, the purpose of monitoring a conservation easement is to make sure the landowner is complying with the terms of the easement agreement. You know, if the state has paid money to a landowner to not farm and not build a structure, well, we want to periodically make sure that the landowner is complying with those terms. Monitoring will detect whether violations have occurred. There haven't been that many violations, but there have been some, and it's reasonable to expect that there will be violations continuing to occur in the future. Monitoring typically involves walking along the perimeter of the property, sometimes through it. As part of our evaluation, we accompanied each of the four easement holders we were evaluating on monitoring visits. So we were out in Mendel County looking at rim easements. We were with DU, Invest Unlimited staff at Shallow Lake easement property. We attended the monitoring training that MLT puts on and accompanied one of their volunteers on a monitoring visit. And we accompanied DNR on a Wild and Scenic River easement monitoring visit. In general, there's not state requirements about monitoring easements. There are some requirements for some specific types of easements. So, for example, statutes require monitoring for forestry easements, but statutes don't require a minimum frequency of those monitoring visits. Some appropriations language, including appropriations from Outdoor Heritage Fund, require a long-term stewardship plan. But again, there's not really guidelines on how often monitoring visits should occur. Based on the consensus standards that we developed, we established a standard of monitoring the property at least once every 3 years. And when we applied that standard to the four easement holders we reviewed, we found some mixed success. Ducks Unlimited and Minnesota Land Trust met our standard with 100% of the easements we reviewed. In fact, for most of their easements, they were conducting annual monitoring visits. Bowser also had a high rate of compliance with our standard. I think it was like 97% of the easements held by Bowser that we reviewed had been monitored at least once every 3 years. DNR did not have as much success meeting the standard. Less than a quarter of the DNR easements we reviewed had been monitored at least once every 3 years. And some of the easement types have been monitored with higher rates of frequency. So the Army compatible use buffer easements, forestry easements, and water bank easements, they all had been monitored at rates that met our standard. The forestry easements had been monitored annually. So DNR is struggling a little bit, but I think there's some important caveats to know about, which you probably already know, but I'll just remind you about them, that many of their easements were acquired in the 70s and 80s, when standards for conservation easements were simply not as well developed. As you know, they have been working hard over the past couple of years to catch up, and they are making progress, but they still have some work to do. So we do have some recommendations regarding monitoring. So first, we think that all easement holders should have long-term stewardship plans for all of their conservation easements, not just those that are funded by certain types of money. We also think that easement holders should monitor state-funded easements every 3 years and then report biannually to the legislature on their monitoring activities. Again, monitoring is the way for the state to protect its investment. Now, again, it's made a significant investment in conservation easements, and monitoring is a way to ensure that there is compliance with the terms of the agreement. Moving on to the third key finding regarding outcomes. We found that easement holders don't really regularly measure the outcomes of the easements beyond reporting the number of acres protected. And while the number of acres protected is important, it may not be the most relevant factor for the outcomes that we're wanting to accomplish with that easement. So, for example, if the purpose of the easement is to keep water on the land longer to help have cleaner water enter our streams, number of acres may not be the most relevant measure. Or if we're trying to increase habitat for a certain bird or animal, again, the number of acres might not be the only thing that matters. And again, we're making a significant public investment. We want to be sure that we're getting a public benefit out of that and a demonstrable public benefit.
I am planning today.
That just Now, we know that it's hard to isolate the effect of a conservation easement on, say, the cleanliness of a river or the number of moose, in part of the state. But there have been some recent efforts to evaluate the impact of conservation easements, and they've been successful efforts in terms of really identifying the benefit in particular of the rim types of easements. So we think this is an important effort that easement holders should make. So our recommendation to the legislature is to require easement holders to regularly report on easement outcomes. Again, this would really help to emphasize, I think, to the public and also to easement holders that we're trying to accomplish something with the easements. We're not, easements aren't an end to themselves. They're a pathway to getting some outcomes that the legislature has identified as important. The last finding I want to talk on briefly is regarding funding for stewardship. And as you know, stewardship includes the monitoring of conservation easements, but also the enforcement of the easement agreement. And really, the funding for stewardship really varies by easement holder and by easement type. So Bowser and DNR have relied largely on general fund money. They've received some dedicated state money in more recent years for stewardship purposes. But again, most of their funding for stewardship is from the general fund. A Minnesota Land Trust, in contrast, has received dedicated money for stewardship. So when it receives an appropriation for acquiring a conservation easement, there is money identified as being able to be set aside for stewardship purposes, and then NLT has a dedicated stewardship fund account that it holds outside of the state treasury. Bex Unlimited has not relied on state money for stewardship of conservation easements in Minnesota. Instead, it relies on membership dues and private donations. One thing to note is they have 9 state-funded conservation easements in Minnesota. So presumably it's easier for them to self-fund the stewardship of 9 easements as opposed to 120 of NLT and then into the thousands per Bowser. But nevertheless, I think this different sources of funding does result in different access to stewardship funding and could have an effect on the type of stewardship provided. This was a question that when we first started the evaluation, there were a lot of concerns about how this is funded and, again, the different access to the money. And at the end of the day, we didn't come down on one model for funding stewardship. Instead, we laid out a number of different options for the legislature to consider and suggested that the legislature, you know, have a discussion about how they want to move forward in funding stewardship of conservation easements. But so to run through the options quickly, So the first option is just keeping the status quo. It's relatively efficient in terms of allocating money at one point in time, at least for MLT. Certainly for Duck Unlimited, it's efficient from the state's standpoint. But again, there is different access to funding for stewardship. Another option is to establish a stewardship advisory committee. This would be a committee with folks who have expertise on stewardship activities or conservation easements. They also have access to a dedicated pot of money, and so then easement holders would receive funding for stewardship through this committee, through a committee project. Another option is simply to have a dedicated fund within the state treasury for conservation easement stewardship. This is kind of like the light version of the stewardship advisory committee, in that there wouldn't be an advisory committee. It would simply be a dedicated fund, and easement holders could submit receipts for the reimbursement for their stewardship activities. We could just rely on the general fund every 2 years. This, of course, would give the legislature the most flexibility. It also would create a lot of uncertainty for easement holders in terms of how much funding they would have for stewardship activities. Also, it could result in insufficient funding being allocated for this purpose and then not enough stewardship and oversight happening. Finally, the legislature could require nonprofit organizations that have state-funded conservation easements to use private money, kind of the Ducks Unlimited model, to pay for its stewardship activities. You know, again, Ducks Unlimited has 9, MLT is 120. You know, it could be a big deterrent to nonprofit organizations partnering with the state. So again, we don't recommend it be one option. We do go through the pros and cons of each, and I think they all do have advantages and disadvantages. In the report on pages 97 and 98, there are a number of other recommendations on topics I didn't really cover here today. I'm happy to answer questions on these or on anything else as the council sees fit. Thank you.
Okay. Just a couple of quick questions regarding the recommendations on slide 11. Monitor state-funded conservation easements every 3 years and biennial reports. Did you consider more than 3 years or less than 3 years? Where did you come up with the three, and why doesn't it match the biennial that's mentioned in a couple different places for reporting?
Sure.
And then the other question was, Bowser seems to be keeping up with their monitoring. Is there something they do that's magical that DNR could adopt?
Great. And I think that last one, the second question first, if that's okay, Mr. Chair and members. Bowser's easements tend to be more straightforward, frankly, than DNR's easements. You know, as we went along on those monitoring trips, and they were really different. When we were with the Renville County Soil and Water Conservation District, I think we monitored more than 20 different easements in one day. Some of them are buffer strips that you really can see from the road. And I'm telling you, if I hadn't gone on the trip and I had been in an interview and they said, well, I just drive by and look, it would have been a finding. You know, I would have been like, what? That can't be sufficient. But when I was with them and we're on the road and they say, well, that post and I can see the whole thing and there's no structures and that's what we're protecting for, I thought, oh, yeah, that is sufficient for monitoring. Compare that to the Wild Sand River easement. Actually, I didn't go on that one. My team went on it and they were actually going to go canoe. You know, they had to go and canoe down the Kettle River, I think it was, to look at some easements that were only accessible that way. Happened to be right around the time of the flooding up in that area, so the canoe trip got canceled, but they still went out and looked at a couple of other easements. But I think in that whole day, they visited one or two easements. So again, the type of easement really matters in terms of how quickly and easily you can monitor. It also depends what's allowed and what's not allowed in the easement design. Okay, so that's that question. The other one, in terms of how we came up with the 3-year standard for monitoring, what we did is we looked at
kind of the literature out there, we looked at what the agencies themselves were saying with their standards. So Minnesota Land Trust and Ducks Unlimited follow the Land Trust Alliance guidelines, which is monitoring annually. So that's a higher standard than our once every 3 years. Bowser monitors once a year for the first 5 years and then switches to an every 3 year model. DNR, it depends on the easement type. Some of them they monitor annually, some of them they move to the 3 year. So really by doing the once every 3 year, it was our minimum. You know, it was kind of, nobody's going to complain with this one because most people are doing more than that. But okay, once every 3 years is a reasonable standard. And then why do we say biennial reporting instead of once every 3 years? Well, it's just kind of the flow and rhythm of the legislature, you know, that it's a biennial legislature. So you wouldn't be reporting on, you know, you wouldn't have monitored every easement in that two-year period, but you could say, well, we last monitored it on, you know, June 7th or June 2010. We found we didn't find any problems. Just, again, something to show that we're doing it and that it's important. It doesn't have to be an elaborate monitoring report. But again, this is the way we're protecting the investment.
So, I know a lot about this.
We brought it up at the December meeting.
Helped set up the accreditation process. But the standard for nonprofits is annual monitoring. States don't like to do it because it costs too much. But frankly, annual is where you find you have a problem, because if you go out every 3 years and someone has started to build a house and you haven't seen it for 2 years, it's built and the cost to enforce it becomes much greater. So there's a cost-benefit kind of a situation. I do want to say that accreditation requires a dedicated stewardship fund. So Ducks Unlimited doesn't depend, which I know you know, but they don't depend on membership dues to pay the stewardship. They get those dues or however they do it and put it into a dedicated fund. So just to clarify, they actually have a dedicated long-term stewardship fund. I don't know if Ducks Unlimited has taken advantage of it. The Minnesota Land Trust has not, because they have done a good job of setting money aside. But the Land Trust Alliance also just launched an insurance company, standalone insurance company, to ensure enforcement of easements nationwide for $60 a year per easement, which does not replace having money in place, but does allow groups that are underfunded to then have resources to be able to defend their easements. Because there are cases where the defense of an easement will cost $1 million. But it is not an insignificant thing.
Mr. Chairman, could I just add just a couple of quick points? Mostly I just want to say and commend to all of you to read this report. Ms. Randall, I think, did a great job of giving you an overview, but a lot of details and issues in here that we didn't cover, and she's kind of enumerated some of them in this last slide, and they get quite detailed, and so we're not going to go through them, and I know you're pressed for time, but I do commend to you the report to look at some of the issues about the potential for mining, issues about appraisal and assessment. Gets to be very controversial in some areas. I would also tell you about an issue that I think is a little more controversial and you might want to consider, and that is that we found in some of the agreements, some of the easement agreements, some provisions that allowed activity that we were a bit surprised by. And that's on page 46, 47. And you will find differences of opinion among people. Mr. Chairman, you are indeed very familiar with this area of activity and may be familiar with the fact that some organizations, we particularly reference MLT, allowing in some of their conservation easements some activities such as bed and breakfast, professional offices, other kinds of activities, even where there is an easement, that may be of some surprise. So, again, my point is not to get into those issues, but simply to highlight for you that there are some details and some issues in here that we did not cover.
So I think you are the folks that I knew know do delve deep into details, and so they're here. And so for your nighttime reading, keep this by the side of your bed, and we'll make it a little more interesting.
Sure.
And I would just tell you, you did a really nice job with someone who knows a little bit about this. Very thorough job there. So with that, thank you for taking us back 15 minutes. And number, seriously, this is a really great report. So next, agenda item 9, accomplishment plan amendment request. This came to staff, and given some of the past discussions that have taken place on this project, we felt that the whole council should hear this request and make a determination as to whether it wanted to grant the amendment.
Mr. Chair, there's an agenda item memo for this in the package, labeled in the lower right-hand corner. Agenda item 9, we have attached to it the letter of request, letter of support, and the revised accomplishment plan. So, with that, we have Scott Booty? Of the Lake Superior Steelhead Association. Go ahead.
Start with the proposed amendment to the plan that's presented is to prepare the second falls of the Meg River. Quick history: in the 70s, before there was any alterations done to it, it was slide and chutes, and fish were able to ascend the river quite easily. At some point in the 70s, there was work done where it was blasting, and they created a pool and a concrete weir at the below the falls. I would say more than 10 years ago, the concrete weir disappeared as weather takes its toll. And this is preventing fish from to prime spawning habitat and rearing versions for young deer fish. We're proposing to pin rocks below the second falls to increase the jumping pool so fish can move. A quick analogy would be a bridge breaks and it gets fixed after it's broken. And that's what we're trying to do.
So one of the things that came early on for this project was a revised, something different than this, which was actually to affect the falls, as I understood it, not by putting rocks below it, but by actually altering the falls, which this does not do.
This does not do.
So that was where the rub came before and the concern came. So just to clarify, this is a different way of addressing the same issue. But because that got so much attention, we really didn't feel that we should not have a full council opportunity to ask questions about this strategy and make sure everyone was clear on it. So with that, any questions? Rick?
Thank you. I'm looking on the accomplishment plan that has a comment about reversibility and unintended impacts of the passage of invasive species. So would sea lamprey be able to traverse the falls when this is completed or not?
Honestly, I don't believe so. This is the second fall. And the first fall is below the Highway 61 expressway. And this is another
a mile and a half
above there. And it's also written in the plan that if there is a problem in the future, the pin rocks can be removed. But also, pin rocks are very solid. As below the first falls, where the Mack River trap, which got destroyed during the large flood last summer, there are pin rocks there that remain.
makes sense.
Other questions? Is there a motion? Either approve or deny the request of Brian?
I make a motion to approve.
Any discussion?
I certainly agree with it being approved. Can I just ask, why can't the staff in DNR decide what was the controversial part of this actually that made it come before? It seems like it makes sense to do.
The original proposal didn't mention alteration of the falls, the accomplishment plan. When we approved it, the accomplishment plan then had a alteration of the falls, which didn't go very far. And this came back as a different way to approve, to alter the falls without actually doing anything to the falls themselves. And because of the sensitivity, we felt it should come back so the council as a whole could understand it. Any other questions? All in favor of the motion? Oh, we need a roll call vote. Sorry.
Jim Cox.
Yes.
Representative Hanson.
Yes.
Chair Hawkins.
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Jane Kingston.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yeah. Yes.
Sue Olson.
Yes.
Scott Grawl.
Yes.
Ron Sherr.
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins.
Yes.
Bob Anderson.
Yes.
Robin Baker.
All right. So thank you for coming down. And next is Forest for the Future, which is a condemnation related alteration.
And Mr. Chair, agenda item 10 has an agenda item memo that has the background, the suggested motion, and a procedure plan.
And we can do this quickly, or we can ask for a full deal. They want to fix a bridge and use the road or widen the road while they're fixing the bridge and pay $1,700 to the fund for doing that in a friendly manner. Is that a good summary of what's going on here?
Yes.
We provided the money for the initial easement. I would certainly recommend we approve this.
So move.
I just want to clarify, this is immediately self-giving. It's not at the south end of St. Louis County, right? West corner. It's up in the middle of St. Louis County.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brent Wilson, DNR. It is, it's actually, there. I think you have this map on the back of the handout. It's south, it looks like the southwest corner of St. Louis County.
Yeah, I don't think that's right. County Road 442 is just south of Living, I think. But I guess it doesn't matter, really.
No, I'll come up in here.
I can certainly, Mr. Chair, I can certainly clarify with the information of the program for this in the interim exactly specified location. But to my knowledge, it's in the southwest corner of San Luis. Like I said, I'm happy to
we'll approve it, Jane, as it is, and if they...
Yeah, the townships that it references, 55 and 56, 21 red range, 21 west, those are just solid hidden. I just want to make sure that what we're talking about is the right thing.
So can we approve what's on the map?
This map is like between one bog and another, so, I mean... That doesn't really help.
It says West Swan River.
West Swan River helps. But the little inset map, I think, is off.
Mr. Chair, I suggest we approve the land description of the paragraph.
Disregard the inset.
Disregard the inset.
Rick?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wilson, how many amendments have we had to this season over the last...
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct. Three. I think it's
Chair. I think it's three. One of which was a condemnation and came to us with no choice.
Mr. Chair, do we anticipate additional ones coming?
Mr. Chair? Talking with Mr. Peterson, he thinks the relative rate of these coming in the last couple of years is quite unusual. The only one that he's aware of that would be upcoming would be in the next 2 to 3 years, and that would be transmission high voltage lines as a part of that project. But he doesn't foresee that coming for a number of years yet. But he knows of no other upcoming projects like this for some time.
Other questions? A roll call vote.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, it's out of the room. Is there a motion?
There was a motion to approve the amendment for the conversion.
And by whom?
I think Bill made the motion, didn't you?
I did.
Thank you. Bob Anderson?
Yes.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Rick Zach Hansen?
Yes.
Mr. Harbaugh?
Yep.
Senator Randy Brickson?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
Yes.
Sue Wilson?
Yes.
Scott Brown? Scott?
Scott, are you there?
Yeah. Was that a yes to the motion?
That was a yes to the motion.
Ron Scherer?
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilson?
Yes.
Great. Next is the approval of the Appleton Plan Amendment for the Northeast Minnesota Short-Tailed Grouse Habitat Partnership.
And you have an agenda item in the three or packet. This is looking at actually two accomplishment plans. They're working together to buy a single piece of property. It's a high-priority piece of property due to its location. It is adjacent to some existing habitat on three sides.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Joe Camelto. I'm the Director of Conservation for Pheasants Forever here in Minnesota. And to my right is Jody Provost, the DNR, who's the private lands biologist up in this area, also the short-tailed grouse from the DNR. We kind of had an interesting opportunity here. We approached the landowners, and originally they were interested in selling about 250 to 300 acres, and the opportunity arose that they could possibly work out a deal to buy the entire ownership. So we'd add an additional 760 acres onto the property. The original Gun Lake property, which was purchased in about 2009, and, you know, obviously, it's a pretty big chunk. The property consists of row cropping right now in Dayton County, so it's able to be farmed for corn and soybeans, and obviously, of the markets that we have now, that's a somewhat more valuable commodity. The other interesting part on this property is it's also possibly able to be mitigated for wetland mitigation. And so there's, we've done the appraisal. It's currently in review. I hear that we'll have that official certified review from the DNR today. And so there is value with, obviously not only being able to farm, being able to be farmed and get income from it, but also the potential to have mitigation where mining companies come in and buy it and do that. And the problem that we're coming into is this is a pretty important short-tailed grouse lek, and it's pretty important to the population there, to the sharptails. But also, if a mining company was to get it, probably they would restore it back and mitigate it to a forest wetland. And obviously, sharptails don't like trees. They like more open space, hay, grass, shrub pasture type areas. And so, not only would we be taking this property out of row crop production, which provides zero value to wildlife, but also that we'd be able to protect it from being mitigated into something that's also not very good for sharptails. And so, Jody's here to just talk quickly kind of the biology behind it, why it's important to deal with the importance of this lactate.
So let me just look at the time. Does anyone question whether or not it's important?
I don't question whether or not it's important, but since this is my first trip to town, I really don't know the history of
all
it.
Right.
So if you would just give me a brief overview of what you originally intended and how this differs.
Yep, I'll thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
So our original, we're going to use our FY13 and FY14 grants, so that'd be Minnesota Law 2012, Minnesota Law 2013 appropriations. And the first year, so Minnesota Law 12, we originally proposed 1,015 acres. And, you know, we're trying to budget, you know, when you're putting together budgets, you're depending on where you think land prices are going to be for that area. And you're kind of looking at your parcel list and saying, I think it's going to be here. So you actually get an appraisal, you don't know. And so we were originally going to purchase 1,015 acres, and after getting the appraisal, we're going to be cut down to 476 acres if we use all of that money. And then we would need more money to purchase it. Then we would have to go into our fiscal year 14 or Minnesota Law 13 appropriation. And they said we were going to purchase 969 acres, and now we're down to 410 acres. So we'll be substantially reducing our acreage or outputs, but that's, we feel that, you know, because the property is a pretty nice property, the importance of it, that it's worthy of coming in and asking for permission. If this was a different property, we'd just walk away and say, it's just.
So, do you have other alternatives that wouldn't cost you as much that you have interest in, or is this, does this rank so far above everything else that your number two isn't worth talking about? How did you get to, let's spend it all here versus do something else?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a great question. And because it is such a quality project, we feel, you know, we really have to try and get this property. And again, we're adding 760 acres, which is, you know, if you can go out and buy 760 acres in one chunk, that's a pretty big deal, you know, especially in these markets. And maybe Joey can just quickly talk about biology.
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair, members. Yeah, first, just a little bit of history about the first 80 acres of this WMA, Gun Lake WMA, that was purchased a few years ago. It was owned by dairy farmers for many years, and a hayfield, which they wanted to sell. But they knew there was a sharp tail left on it, and the sharp tail left was assessed as being one of the 13 most important sharp tail left species. Based on a study done about a dozen years ago, as far as its persistence and longevity and number of birds that use it. So it's considered a very important source population. And dairy farmers were approached by the farmers that wanted to purchase the 80, and the dairy farmers knew that if those people bought it, it would become a black egg field, and the lack would be lost and the local population lost. So they very patiently waited while DNR worked with many partners, including Pheasant Scrubber, the Nature Conservancy, Rough Grouse Society, a couple local deer hunter association chapters. There was a lot of local support to drum up money to acquire this 80 to protect nesting habitat and the dancing ground, which is a very important hub of the local population. And so we're able to do that. And now the benefits to being able to add to this 80 acres are great from the biological end of it. As you heard in the climate change workshop, it's important to conserve and connect habitat. We'll be doing that. It's going to connect up to county brushlands. We'll be sequestering carbon. It'll be important to water quality also, because you can see the Mississippi River is right there on the upper right or upper left of the map. Also, you know, as you know, sharp tailed grouse are species of great conservation need. So we will be benefiting them most importantly, but also sharp tailed grouse are very important to come back, and bass are the, like to call brother Russian wildlife. That's really good with other species of wildlife that you open with the Russians will also benefit. Many of them also species of greatest conservation need, including everything from northern shrikes, yellow whales, short-eared owls, as well as some of our game species for that.
Eric?
Oh, yeah. And also, right now, it serves as a research site. We're doing a 2-year research study to improve our management of sharp-tailed grouse, and so we're capping birds and putting radio collars on them there so that we can find out what kind of habitat they're using and improve our management techniques. Also, sharp-tailed grouse need a large home range. We need, according to a viability assessment, population viability assessment, north of Wisconsin, we need at least to maintain a population of about 15 square miles of habitat. So this will help secure that. They're also, Aiken County is in the heart of our East Central Sharp-tailed Grouse range, and based on a habitat model density analysis that we've done in DNR, the location of is a very important site, and probably most importantly is the genetic aspect. I don't know if you're aware of Wisconsin, their populations become very isolated and they get very poor genetic diversity. In fact, we sort of have a picture recently from genetics of grass swans, which described as Wisconsin's sort of genetic vortex, where they're getting such isolated populations that now are starting to kind of blink out. So we don't want to get to that point. It's easier to do the habitat in up front than to have on the back end. I do like Wisconsin and actually translocate birds to improve that genetic diversity. I guess for all these reasons, and finally, less biological but more of an outreach, is this blind. We've had a sharp-tailed blind on the site for about 20 years now. It's a very important outreach to the public to help them understand the importance of these birds and their habitat and other wildlife that use the area. So having that accessible, dependable spot for the public to enjoy the birds and therefore appreciate and support habitat for those.
And that's on existing gun lake WMA, not the property that's in court.
Right. It's on the existing.
Just
yep.
Great.
Mr.
Chair?
Yep. Go ahead, Scott.
The audio is coming through kind of in and out, but just one clarification for me. I was reading over the accomplishment plan paperwork that had been sent to me. In one place it references this acquisition as an AMA being added on to a WMA. This is actually an additional WMA acquisition. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct. Yes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for reading so carefully, Scott. Susan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't aware that there was a Pheasants Forever-related project on the agenda until I saw Joe come up. I am a past president of the Moore County Pheasants Forever Group, and although I'm no longer doing anything with the chapter, I see it as a conflict of interest for me for about a year or so, so I'll be abstaining from any votes on PF projects.
Okay.
Are there any other colony project or research going on that you have? In Minnesota, this is where the study site includes this area along the Palisades, also in the Tamarack, and also in the Meadows. We have 3 sites here capturing the rating in the bridge.
Rick?
In the greater than 80 square miles. And mitigation, is there any core benefit or replacement? Mr. Chair, so the threat, if we don't do this, is that it could be purchased for mitigation, and that's probably what's driving up the value of the cost. So there's an imminent development threat, even though it's not for building, it's for mitigation.
Mr. Chair and members, I talked with the appraiser on this, and my limited knowledge of mitigation, I just know enough to be dangerous. But what's happening is the mining companies up north, obviously can't mitigate in their county, so they're moving down to these areas and buying large chunks.
Maybe you have something else for you.
I wanted to comment that it was done by standards defined by DNR, so that's good, in my opinion. It must be sad.
I guess I would just make one more comment. I don't want to make it, if this property does fall through for some reason, that we're going to stick with these acres and make these just for this project. So if it falls through, then we would have been back to our original.
So is someone willing to make a motion as per the suggested motion on your item, agenda item 11?
So moved.
So there's a motion. Jenny, you have a comment?
I just have a question, a couple of them. Is the homestead on the upper, in the northeast corner, there's some north of Chalk Avenue, is what's going to happen there? Is that going to be abandoned, or is it currently abandoned?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, right now it's an abandoned home. It's a pretty small old home that nobody's lived in. Then there's a couple, I guess, I don't even know what you call them, hay barns where the sides are open and there's a roof on top. And those would be removed prior to the property being transferred to the owner.
And then if I can follow up, so it's like $2,900. You have reason to believe that that appraisal will hold up to that high of a number in this area?
I believe so.
And then if I can follow up, if what Representative Hansen was alluding to, if the mining companies buy it for mitigation purposes, what actually happens to the land when they do that? And how much does it cost the state if they do that?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, it's my understanding that it would be restored back to a forest and wetland, and sharptails don't want trees. So we're possibly purchasing to prevent that from happening. Otherwise, right now, it's a pretty open landscape. And if we have, now 760 acres of trees around the site, your life will probably go away.
And that's what you had already said. I wasn't paying attention maybe as well as I should. So, thank you. You answered my question.
Jane?
Is this tile?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it's there's a few tile out there to drain the surface water. But the water table is pretty high, so that's why it is able to be used as a mitigation site, because there is some subsurface drainage. But it's
otherwise
not.
It'll go right back to what it was.
Yeah. So we would mostly just leave it and we'll go ahead and scrub it. Swampy type of area.
Burn it. Any other questions? Can we do a roll call vote?
Bob Anderson?
Yes.
James Cox?
Yes.
Yes. David
Noble? Yes.
Cyber Anderson?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
I'm going to vote no. No.
Scott Rawl?
Yeah.
Too much. I don't want to rant.
Scott Sharrow?
Too much.
Yes.
No, not much
more. Elizabeth Rosen?
Yes.
Of course.
No. Okay. It's going to pass. Yeah.
And yet, one no, right?
Five yes, one
no. Sorry, don't worry.
Motion passes. Good luck. Next is agenda item 12, accomplishment plan approval. Bill?
As you will recall, on an annual basis, after the legislature has crafted its appropriations bill, we approve the accomplishment plan that constitutes the agreement between the recipient and the legislature with regard to what's going to be done with the money that's been appropriated. These accomplishment plans are attached to the contract. That's why it was important to make a change that we just saw in the rough browsing to get that officially amended. What we're asking you to do today is to approve a consent agenda that is listed on agenda item 12. There are, I believe, 31 programs on the consent agenda. The amount of money didn't change since November when we saw the draft, and the outlooks and outcomes haven't changed. There is one item on the non-consent agenda, which we'll take up in a future meeting. It's habitat protection in Dakota County, and the reason we did not put it on the consent agenda was the program manager is grossly tardy in status reports, final reports, and things like that. So we have leverage to hopefully get in to turn the reports in so we can start with the money. Is that sufficient of a question?
I'm seeing a man from one of our members
who lives in Dakota County.
So, what we're looking for is a motion to approve the consent agenda accomplishment plan. So, once the 1st of July rolls over, people can start spending money. Is there a motion to do that? Ron, you're moving consent agenda items for approval. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Oh, sorry, it's a roll call vote. You can't do that. Darn you, Scott.
Paul Manchin?
Yes.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Justin Hanson?
Yes.
Yes.
Larry. Yes. Jen
Kingston? Yes. Representative McNamara? Yes. Sue Olson? Yes. Scott Rawl? Yes. Tom Sharp? Yes. 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 All right. Pass it. Next is I'd like to talk about a July meeting.
We've had preliminary discussions with Metropolitan Council about taking a look at the resources available for restoration and enhancement in the metropolitan area. So we all have a common idea of what is available to these days. We've had a little bit of a discussion with Keith Parker, DNR, to see if there's something he may add into a tour. So we've got those items on our next agenda, which would be the tour of the metropolitan area. Generally, we have accomplishment plan approvals for similar things in order. And there may be some progress on how we should proceed with the annual versus biennial appropriation, which we would update people on and that sort of thing. I want to inquire, Heather, if there's something I'm missing that we discussed for this potential July tour.
So we did a doodle poll. We had 10 people respond. The two dates that were most selected with 9 votes each were the 9th and the 18th of July. We did not hear from Rick and Ron yet. So you have your chance to throw in your votes here before we do anything. Are either of you available the 18th or not available?
Mr. Chair, we're hosting a Midwestern Legislative Conference the 13th through the 17th in St. Paul. The number of folks we're tied up with, so the 9th would be better rather than the 18th, because we'll be doing wrap up and mop up after.
Ron, do you have a...
Well, it's a little embarrassing to say, but I don't do my own schedule.
You're going to lose today.
I'm going to lose. So you just have to proceed, and I will try my darndest to accommodate the council.
Does anyone object to scheduling the meeting on the 9th?
I have a soil and water meeting that afternoon.
you know, much of the afternoon. So would we be doing our business in the morning and then maybe tour in the afternoon, that kind of thing, so that I could be a part of that meeting before my trip back home?
Mr. Chair, yes, to the extent we have business, the meeting will be in the morning.
Okay. Bob, I know this doesn't work for you, but...
Well, I mean, I just come down the night before.
Okay.
Get your agenda again.
Thank you for your... We will schedule it on the 9th, so everyone mark that on your schedule, please. We'll get out an official notice to everyone as well.
What time is it?
We'll start at 8 o'clock. So now we've gone through all of our agenda other than public comments. I'm not aware of anyone from the public who has made arrangements to make public comments, but this is your opportunity, should you wish to make public comments, to do so.
Sure.
Scott, are you wanting to make a public comment?
No, I don't, but I would like about 30 seconds with the council after the tape is shut off.
I don't think we can do that, Scott. But we'll give you the 30 seconds, but let me make sure there's nobody... I'm not seeing anybody coming down for public comments, so Scott, you have the floor.
Well, it's an update on my wife's condition. I prefer not to do it on the tape.
I think we can close the tape for that. So we're going to adjourn the formal meeting.